Are you searching for the best in online black radio? Then go to blacktalkradionetwork.com, helping you filter through the noise. Real talk, black talk.
The internet is full of half-truths and all-out lies. We've all seen them, and many people on social media complaining about it. Here's your chance to show improve. WorldAfropedia.com is a black-owned and operated encyclopedia. There are several thousand articles, but we need help. We can't uncover all the truth ourselves. So please, join us and become a writer, editor, or blogger for WorldAfropedia.com today. Every little bit counts. We owe it to the future generations to put the truth out there. Visit WorldAfropedia.com, the African-centered encyclopedia, a global database of African knowledge for the purpose of bringing about global African wisdom and understanding. WorldAfropedia.com.
Reading Fanon. The year was 1969. When a small group of young men formed the Philadelphia branch of the Black Panther Party. I was among them, and being barely 15, was the youngest, but my height and size made me seem older. Being a Panther meant not just long, hard work in the community. It meant spending time studying and reading materials that were not familiar. I remember reading Frantz Fanon's The Wretched of the Earth, or rather, tried to. It was written for adults, scholars, revolutionaries, or psychologists. It wasn't written for kids who hadn't graduated high school. Yet orders were orders. So I slogged through the English translation published by Grove Press. I can't say I understood much of it, but some things stuck with me and caused me to think, not about the conditions of besieged Algerians facing French colonialism and domination, but of the life of black folks here in America. One intriguing segment stuck in my mind. Fanon wrote, "While the settler or the policeman has the right the livelong day to strike the native, to insult him, and to make him crawl to them. You'll see the native reaching for his knife at the slightest hostile or aggressive glance cast on him by another native. For the last resort of the native is to defend his personality vis-a-vis his brother. It is as if plunging into a fraternal bloodbath allowed them to ignore the obstacle and to put off till later the choice, nevertheless inevitable, which opens up the question of armed resistance to colonialism. Thus, collective auto-destruction, in a very concrete form, is one of the ways in which the native's muscular tension is set free." When I looked outside the office on Columbia Avenue or out the window of our apartment on Oxford Street, I saw what he described played out as if he were reading my mind. Every Friday or Saturday night, the neighborhood would be in the throes of self-directed violence. For the slightest offense. If a brother stepped on another brother's shoe, he could die this weekend. The hospitals did a brisk business in sewing up black folks on the weekend. This I saw, and it gave me tremendous insight into the psychic wounds of oppression, whether one was in the so-called Arab Quarter in Algiers or on Girard Avenue in North Philadelphia. In essence, it was the same thing. I read him then because it was required of us all. And afterwards, in PE or political education classes, we might be called on to discuss and explain our readings, or worse, teach it to people in the community. But truth be told, much of it was Greek to me. Manichaeistic? Pathological? Huh? But the drive to learn is a remarkable thing. So is duty. So you read and read until some things pierce the fog of understanding. Years later, when I reread Fanon, I became intoxicated with his ideas, his analysis, and indeed his predictions of how Africa would emerge from the colonial era into neo-colonialism. Few have performed such a task with Fanon's brilliance or with his acuity of vision. One need only look at passages from The Wretched of the Earth regarding the African bourgeoisie to see how these words, penned over half a century ago, could have been written the very day these words are written. Fanon wrote the following. "The national bourgeoisie, which has totally assimilated colonialist thought in its most corrupt form, takes over from the Europeans and establishes in the continent a racial philosophy which is extremely harmful for the future of Africa. From nationalism, we have passed into ultranationalism, to chauvinism, and finally, to racism. Fanon's insights could be summarized in place names like Rwanda, Sudan, Burundi, Liberia, and Nigeria, just to state a few. Kenyan writer and activist Koigiwa Wamwere likened the vast loss of African life to that of an atom bomb, a weapon of mass destruction, which he called and wrote a book entitled Negative Ethnicity. And the real reason isn't because Hutus hate Tutsis or Luos hate Kikuyu or Zulus hate Swazis. It's because the work of decolonization was never truly completed. According to Wamwere, over 5 million African men, women, and children have died from civil wars and ethnic rivalries since the independence movements of the 60s resulted in so-called independence. Thus, Fanon's warnings, if heeded, could have prevented the deaths of some 5 million people in the last half of the 20th century. But it would be misleading to paint Fanon as some kind of prophet. He was a man active in the freedom movements of millions. He knew, met with, and worked with Congo's Patrice Lumumba, its rightful representative, until the UN-CIA plot to unseat and assassinate him. Lumumba was slain less than a year after the August 1960 meeting of the Pan-African Conference in Leopoldville, where the two men met. Afterwards, Fanon issued a stiff warning to African leaders about the nature of colonialism and the need for such leaders to fight against these alien destructive influences. In his book, African Revolution, Fanon wrote, "Africa must understand that there will not be one Africa that fights against colonialism and another that attempts to make arrangements with colonialism. Our mistake, the mistake we Africans made, was to have forgotten that the enemy never withdraws sincerely. He never understands. He capitulates, but he does not become converted. Our mistake is to have believed that the enemy has lost his combativeness and his harmfulness. If Lumumba is in the way, Lumumba disappears. Hesitation to murder has never characterized imperialism. Look at Bin Mahidi. Look at Mumia. Look at Lumumba. Our mistake is to have been slightly confused in what we did. It is a fact that in Africa today, traitors exist. They should have been denounced and fought. The fact that this is hard after the magnificent dream of an Africa gathered together unto itself and subject to the same requirements of true independence does not alter facts. Let us be sure never to forget it. The fate of all of us is at stake in the Congo." Frantz Fanon had a profound impact on leaders and members of the Black Panther Party. Indeed, before the BPP was even organized, Bobby Seale loaned his copy of The Wretched of the Earth to Huey P. Newton, who was so intrigued by the work that he read it 6 times. Because Newton was a notoriously slow but deep reader, this gives us some idea of its influence on the man. Kathleen Neal Cleaver, then the party's communications secretary, wrote years later that the first lines of Fanon's book gripped her, quote, "National liberation, national renaissance, the restoration of nationhood to a people. Whatever may be the headings used or the new formulas introduced, decolonization is always a violent phenomenon." Frantz Fanon, although he died at an early age, impacted the lives of people all around the world. He, of course, made a tremendous impact with his writings, but beyond those were his professional and political pursuits. He was a doctor, a psychiatrist, and a revolutionary who worked with the FLN in Algeria. In his practice, he not only treated combatants who suffered from torture, but French torturers who often complained of hearing screams in their dreams. His diagnosis? Quit torturing people. He changed treatment regimens for psychiatric patients at Blida Hospital in Algeria, saying that hospitalization should be minimized as the patient should experience as much liberty at home life as possible. He learned Arabic to listen to and speak to his patients so as to protect the doctor-patient confidentiality. He worked as a clandestine cadre for the Front de Liberation Nationale, the National Liberation Front, or FLN. He was expelled from Algeria and went to Tunis to become editor of El Mujahid, the FLN organ, and was appointed director of FLN health clinics. He was named Algerian representative of the provisional government. He was an exemplary revolutionary, a freedom fighter, a thinker, and a humanist. he will be long remembered. I thank you. From death row for La Fondation Fanon, this is Mumia Abu-Jamal.
Context of White Supremacy, Gus T. Renegade in for another broadcast, hopefully to share constructive information on the system of white supremacy. Today's date, Friday, August 11th, 2017, so I have been told. This is our third study session on Frantz Fanon's The Wretched of the Earth. We're picking up from me. This is at the top of 68. Last week we left off the question, when do we start? So this week we're picking up the very next paragraph, this meeting of revolutionaries coming from the towns and country dwellers. That's what we're picking up from me. It's on 68. Might be slightly different depending on your version of the text. Without further ado, we will get started. Again, Frantz Fanon, The Wretched of the Earth. Context of White Supremacy, audio segment number one.
This meeting of revolutionaries coming from the towns and county dwellers will be dealt with later on. For the moment, we must go back to the political parties in order to show the nature of their action, which is all the same progressive. In their speeches, the political leaders give a name to the nation. In this way, the nation's demands are given shape. This is, however, no definite subject matter and no political or social program. There is a vague outline or skeleton which is nevertheless national in form, what we describe as minimum requirements. The politicians who make speeches and who write in the nationalist newspapers make the people dream dreams. They avoid the actual overthrowing of the state, but in fact they introduce into their readers or hearers' consciousness the terrible ferment of subversion. The national or tribal language is often used. Here, once again, dreams are encouraged, and the imagination is let loose outside the bounds of the colonial order. And sometimes these politicians speak of, quote, we Negroes, we Arabs. And these terms, which are so profoundly ambivalent, take on, during the colonial epoch, a sacramental signification. The nationalist politicians are playing with fire, for, as an African leader recently warned a group of young intellectuals, think well before you speak to the masses, for they flare up quickly. This is one of the terrible tricks that destiny plays in the colonies. When a political leader calls a mass meeting, we may say that there is blood in the air. Yet the same leader very often is above all anxious to, quote, make a show of force so that in fact he need not use it. But the agitation which ensues, the coming and going, the listening to speeches, seeing the people assembled in one place, with the police all around, the military demonstrations, arrest, and the deportation of the leaders, all this hubbub makes the people think that the moment has come for them to take action. In these times of instability, the political parties multiply their appeals to the left for calm, while on their right they scan the horizon trying to make out the liberal intentions of colonialism. In the same way, the people make use of certain episodes in the life of the community in order to hold themselves ready and to keep alive their revolutionary zeal. For example, the gangster who holds up the police set on to track him down for days on end, or who dies in a single combat after having killed four or five policemen, or who commits suicide in order not to give away his accomplices, these types light the way for the people, form the blueprints for action, and become heroes. Obviously, it's a waste of breath to say that such and such a hero is a thief, a scoundrel, or a reprobate. If the act for which he is prosecuted by the colonial authorities is an act exclusively directed against a colonialist person or a colonialist property, the demarcation line is definite and manifest. The process of identification is automatic. We must also notice in this ripening process the whole role played by the history of the resistance at the time of the conquest. The great figures of the colonized people are always those who led the national resistance to invasion. Bahanazin, Sundiata, Samari, Abdel, Kader all spring again to life with peculiar intensity in the period which comes directly before action. This is the proof that the people are getting ready to begin to go forward again, to put an end to the static period begun by colonization, and to make history. The uprising of the new nation and the breaking down of colonial structures are the result of one of two causes, either of a violent struggle of the people in their own right, or of action on the part of surrounding colonized people, which acts as a break on the colonial regime in question. A colonized people is not alone. In spite of all that colonialism can do, its frontiers remain open to new ideas and echoes from the world outside. It discovers that violence is in the atmosphere, that it is here and there burst out, and here and there sweeps away the colonial regime. That same violence which fulfills for the nation a role that is not simply informatory, but also operative. The great victory of the Vietnamese people at Dien Bien Phu is no longer, strictly speaking, a Vietnamese victory. Since July 1954, the question which the colonized people have asked themselves has been, what must be done to bring about another Dien Bien Phu? How can we manage it? Not a single colonized individual could ever doubt the possibility of a Dien Bien Phu. The only problem was how best to use the forces at their disposal, how to organize them, and when to bring them into action. This encompassing violence does not work upon the colonized people only. It modifies the attitude of the colonialists who become aware of manifold Dien Bien Phus. This is why a veritable panic takes hold of the colonialist governments in turn. Their purpose is to capture the vanguard, to turn the movement of liberation toward the right, and to disarm the people. Quick, quick, let's decolonize. Decolonize the Congo before it turns into another Algeria. Vote the constitutional framework for all Africa. Create the French Communauté. Renovate that same Communauté. But for God's sake, let's decolonize quick. And they decolonize at such a rate that they impose independence on Houphouët Boigny. To the strategy of Dien Bien Phu, defined by the colonized peoples, the colonialist replies by the strategy of encirclement, based on the respect of the sovereignty of states. But let us return to the atmosphere of violence, that violence which is just under the skin. We have seen that in its process toward maturity, many leads are attached to it, to control it and show it the way out. Yet, in spite of the metamorphosis which the colonial regime imposes upon it in the way of tribal or regional quarrels, that violence makes its way forward, and the native identifies his enemy and recognizes all his misfortunes, throwing all the exacerbated might of his hate and anger into this new channel. But how do we pass from the atmosphere of violence to violence in action? What makes the lid blow off? There is first of all the fact that this development does not leave the settler's blissful existence intact. The settler, who, quote, understands the natives, is made aware by several straws in the wind showing that something is afoot. Quote, good natives become scarce. Silence falls when the oppressor approaches. Sometimes looks are black and attitudes are and remarks openly aggressive. The nationalist parties are astir. They hold a great many meetings. The police are increased, and reinforcements of soldiers are brought in. The settlers, above all, the farmers, isolated on their land, are the first to become alarmed. They call for energetic measures. The authorities do, in fact, take some spectacular measures. They arrest one or two leaders. They organize military parades and maneuvers and Air Force displays. But the demonstrations and warlike exercises, the smell of gunpowder which now fills the atmosphere, these things do not make the people draw back. Those bayonets and cannonades only serve to reinforce their aggressiveness. The atmosphere becomes dramatic, and everyone wishes to show that he is ready for anything. And it is in these circumstances that the guns go off by themselves, for nerves are jangled, fear reigns, and everyone is trigger-happy. A single commonplace incident is enough to start the machine gunning. Satif in Algeria, the Central Quarries in Morocco, Moramenga in Madagascar. The repressions, far from calling a halt to the forward rush of national consciousness, urge it on. Mass slaughter in the colonies at a certain stage of the embryonic development of consciousness increases that consciousness. For the hecatombs are an indication that between oppressors and oppressed, everything can be solved by force. It must be remarked here that the political parties have not called for an armed insurrection and have made no preparations for such an insurrection. All these repressive measures, all those actions which are a result of fear, are not within the leaders' intentions. They are overtaken by events. At this moment, then, colonialism may decide to arrest the nationalist leaders. But today, the governments of colonized countries know very well that it is extremely dangerous to deprive the masses of their leaders, for then the people, unbridled, fling themselves into jacqueries, mutinies, and brutish murders. The masses give free rein to their bloodthirsty instincts and force colonialism to free their leaders, to whom falls the difficult task of bringing them back to order. The colonized people, who have spontaneously brought their violence to the colossal task of destroying the colonial system, will very soon find themselves with the barren, inert slogan, "Release X or Y." Then colonialism will release these men and hold discussions without them. The time for dancing in the streets has come. In certain circumstances, the party political machine may remain intact, but as a result of the colonialist repression and of the spontaneous reaction of the people, the parties find themselves outdistanced by their militants. The violence of the masses is vigorously pitted against the military forces of the occupying power, and the situation deteriorates and comes to a head. Those leaders who are free remain, therefore, on the touchline. They have suddenly become useless, with their bureaucracy and their reasonable demands. Yet we see them, far removed from events, attempting the crowning imposture, that of speaking in the name of the silenced nation. As a general rule, colonialism welcomes this godsend with open arms, transforms these blind mouths into spokesmen, and in 2 minutes endows them with independence on condition that they restore order. So we see that all parties are aware of the power of such violence, and that the question is not always to reply to it by greater violence, but rather to see how to relax the tension. What is the real nature of this violence? We have seen that it is the intuition of the colonized masses that their liberation must and can only be achieved by force. By what spiritual aberration do these men, without technique, starving and enfeebled, confronted with the military and economic might of the occupation, come to believe that violence alone will free them? How can they hope to triumph? It is because violence, and this is the disgraceful thing, may constitute, in so far as it forms part of its system, the slogan of a political party. The leaders may call on the people to enter upon an armed struggle. This problematical question has to be thought over. When militarist Germany decides to settle its frontier disputes by force, we are not in the least surprised. But when the people of Angola, for example, decide to take up arms, when the Algerian people reject all means which are not violent, these are proofs that something has happened or is happening at this very moment. The colonized races, those slaves of modern times, are impatient. They know that this apparent folly alone can put them out of reach of colonial oppression. A new type of relations is established in the world. The underdeveloped peoples try to break their chains, and the extraordinary thing is that they succeed. It could be argued that in these days of Sputniks, it is ridiculous to die of hunger. But for the colonized masses, the argument is more down to earth. The truth is that there is no colonial power today which is capable of adopting the only form of contest which has a chance of succeeding, namely, the prolonged establishment of large forces of occupation. As far as their internal situation is concerned, the colonialist countries find themselves faced with contradictions in the form of working class demands which necessitate the use of their police forces. As well, in the present international situation, these countries need their troops to protect their regimes. Finally, there is the well-known myth of liberating movements directed from Moscow. In the regime's panic-stricken reasoning, this signifies, quote, if that goes on, there is a risk that the communists will turn the troubles to account and infiltrate into these parts, end quote. In the native's eagerness, the fact that he openly brandishes the threat of violence proves that he is conscious of the unusual character of the contemporary situation and that he means to profit by it. But, still on the level of immediate experience, the native, who has seen the modern world penetrate into the furthermost corners of the bush, is most acutely aware of all the things he does not possess. The masses, by a sort of, if we may say so, childlike process of reasoning, convince themselves that they have been robbed of all these things. That is why in certain undeveloped countries, the masses forge ahead very quickly and realize 2 or 3 years after independence that they have been frustrated, that, quote, it wasn't worthwhile fighting and that nothing could really change. In 1789, after the bourgeois revolution, the smallest French peasants benefited substantially from the upheaval. But it is a commonplace to observe and to say that in the majority of cases, for 95% of the population of undeveloped countries, independence brings no immediate change. The enlightened observer takes note of the existence of a kind of mass discontent. like the smoking ashes of a burnt-down house after the fire has been put out, which still threatened to burst into flames again. So, they say that the natives want to go too quickly. Now, let us never forget that only a very short time ago they complained of their slowness, their laziness, and their fatalism. Already we see that violence used in specific ways at the moment of the struggle for freedom does not magically disappear after the ceremony of trooping the national colors. It has all the less reason for disappearing since the reconstruction of the nation continues within the framework of cutthroat competition between capitalism and socialism. This competition gives an almost universal dimension to even the most localized demands. Every meeting held, every act of repression committed, reverberates in the international arena. The murders of Sharpeville shook public opinion for months. In the newspapers, over the wavelengths, and in private conversations, Sharpeville has become a symbol. It was through Sharpeville that men and women first became acquainted with the problem of apartheid in South Africa. Moreover, we cannot believe that demagoguery alone is the explanation for the sudden interest the big powers show in the petty affairs of undeveloped regions. Each jacquery, each act of sedition in the Third World makes up part of a picture framed by the Cold War. Two men are beaten up in Salisbury, and at once the whole of a block goes into action, talks about those two men, and uses the beating up incident to bring up the particular problem of Rhodesia, linking it, moreover, with the whole African question and with the whole question of colonized people. The other bloc, however, is equally concerned in measuring by the magnitude of the campaign the local weaknesses of its system. Thus, the colonized peoples realize that neither clan remains outside local incidents. They no longer limit themselves to regional horizons, for they have caught on to the fact that they live in an atmosphere of international stress. When every 3 months or so we hear that the 6th or 7th Fleet is moving towards such and such a coast, when Khrushchev threatens to come to Castro's aid with rockets, when Kennedy decides upon some desperate solution for the Laos question, the colonized person, or the newly independent native, has the impression that whether he wills it or not, he is being carried away in a kind of frantic cavalcade. In fact, he is marching in it already. Let us take, for example, the case of the governments of recently liberated countries. The men at the head of affairs spend two-thirds of their time in watching their approaches and trying to anticipate the dangers which threaten them, and the remaining one-third of their time in working for their country. At the same time, they search for allies. Obedient to the same dialectic, the national parties of opposition leave the paths of parliamentary behavior. They also look for allies to support them in their ruthless ventures into sedition. The atmosphere of violence, after having colored all the colonial phase, continues to dominate national life. For as we have already said, the Third World is not cut off from the rest. Quite the contrary, it is at the middle of the whirlpool. This is why the statesmen of underdeveloped countries keep up indefinitely the tone of aggressiveness and exasperation in their public speeches, which in the normal way ought to have disappeared. Herein also may be found the reasons for that lack of politeness so often spoken of in connection with newly established rulers. But what is less visible in the extreme courtesy of these same rulers in their contacts with their brothers or their comrades? Discourtesy is first and foremost a manner to be used in dealings with the others, with the former colonists who come to observe and investigate. The quote, ex-native, too often gets the impression that these reports are already written. The photos which illustrate the article are simply a proof that one knows what one is talking about and that one has visited the country. The report intends to verify the evidence. Everything's going badly out there since we left. Frequently, reporters complain of being badly received or being forced to work under bad conditions and of being fenced round by indifference or hostility. All this is quite normal. The nationalist leaders know that international opinion is formed solely by the Western press. Now, when a journalist from the West asks us questions, it is seldom in order to help us. In the Algerian War, for example, even the most liberal of the French reporters never ceased to use ambiguous terms in describing our struggle. When we reproached them for this, they replied in all good faith that they were being objective. For the native, objectivity is always directed against him. We may in the same way come to understand the new tone which swamped international diplomacy at the United Nations General Assembly in September 1960. The representatives of the colonial countries were aggressive and violent and carried things to extremes, but the colonial peoples did not find that they exaggerated. The radicalism of the African spokesman brought the abscess to a head and showed up the inadmissible nature of the veto and of the dialogue between the great powers, and above all the tiny role reserved for the Third World. Diplomacy, as inaugurated by the newly independent peoples, is no longer an affair of nuances, of implications, and of hypnotic passes. For the nation's spokesmen are responsible at one and the same time for safeguarding the unity of the nation, the progress of the masses toward a state of well-being, and the right of all peoples to bread and liberty. Thus, it is a diplomacy which never stops moving, a diplomacy which leaps ahead, in strange contrast to the motionless, petrified world of colonization. And when Mr. Khrushchev brandishes his shoe at the United Nations, or thumps the table with it, there's not a single ex-native, nor any representative of an underdeveloped country who laughs. For what Mr. Khrushchev shows the colonized countries, which are looking on, is that he, the Mujik, who moreover is the possessor of space rockets, treats these miserable capitalists in the way that they deserve. In the same way, Castro, sitting in military uniform in the United Nations organization, does not scandalize the underdeveloped countries. What Castro demonstrates is the consciousness he has of the continued existence of the rule of violence. The astonishing thing is that he did not come into the UNO with a machine gun. But if he had, would anyone have minded? All the jacqueries and desperate needs, all those bands armed with cutlasses or axes, find their nationality in the implacable struggle which opposes socialism and capitalism. In 1945, the 45,000 dead at Sétif could pass unnoticed. in 1947, the 90,000 dead in Madagascar could be the subject of a simple paragraph in the papers. In 1952, the 200,000 victims of the repression in Kenya could meet with relative indifference. This was because the international contradictions were not sufficiently distinct. Already the Korean and Indochinese wars had begun a new phase, but it is above all Budapest and Suez which constitute the decisive moments of this confrontation. Strengthened by the unconditional support of the socialist countries, the colonized peoples fling themselves with whatever arms they have against the impregnable citadel of colonialism. If this citadel is invulnerable to knives and naked fists, it is no longer so when we decide to take into account the context of the Cold War. In this fresh juncture, the Americans take their role of patron of international capitalism very seriously. Early on, they advised the European countries to decolonize in a friendly fashion. Later on, they do not hesitate to proclaim first the respect for and then the support of the principle of, quote, Africa for the Africans. The United States is not afraid today of stating officially that they are the defenders of the right of all peoples to self-determination. Mr. Menin Williams' last journey is only the illustration of the consciousness which the Americans have that the Third World ought not to be sacrificed. From then on, we understand why the violence of the native is only hopeless if we compare it in the abstract to the military machine of the oppressor. On the other hand, if we situate that violence in the dynamics of the international situation, we see at once that it constitutes a terrible menace for the oppressor. Persistent jacqueries and Mau Mau disturbance unbalance the colony's economic life, but do not endanger the mother country. What is more important in the eyes of imperialism is the opportunity for socialist propaganda to infiltrate among the masses and to contaminate them. This is already a serious danger in the Cold War, but what would happen to that colony in case of real war, riddled as it is by murderous guerrillas? Thus, capitalism realizes that its military strategy has everything to lose by the outbreak of nationalist wars. Again, within the framework of peaceful coexistence, all colonies are destined to disappear, and in the long run, neutralism is destined to be respected by capitalism. What must at all costs be avoided is strategic insecurity. The breakthrough of enemy doctrine into the masses and the deep-rooted hatred of millions of men. The colonized peoples are very well aware of these imperatives which rule international political life. For this reason, even those who thunder denunciations of violence take their decisions and act in terms of this universal violence. Today, peaceful coexistence between the two blocs provokes and feeds violence in the colonial countries. Tomorrow, perhaps, we shall see the shifting of that violence after the complete liberation of the colonial territories. Perhaps we will see the question of minorities cropping up. Already, certain minority groups do not hesitate to preach violent methods for resolving their problems, and it is not by chance, so the story runs, that in consequence, Negro extremists in the United States organize a militia and arm themselves. It is not by chance either that in the so-called free world there exist committees for the defense of Jewish minorities in the USSR. nor an accident if General de Gaulle, in one of his orations, sheds tears over the millions of Muslims oppressed by communist dictatorship. Both capitalism and imperialism are convinced that the struggle against racialism and the movements toward national freedom are purely and simply directed by remote control, fomented from outside. So they decide to use that very efficacious tactic, the Radio Free Europe station, voice of the Committee for the Aid of Overruled Minorities. They practice anti-colonialism, as did the French colonels in Algeria when they carried on subversive warfare with the SAS, or the psychological services. They, quote, use the people against the people, end quote. We have seen with what results. This atmosphere of violence and menaces, these rockets brandished by both sides, do not frighten nor deflect the colonized peoples. We have seen that all their recent history has prepared them to understand and grasp the situation between the violence of the colonies and that peaceful violence that the world is steeped in. There is a kind of complicit agreement, a sort of homogeneity. The colonized peoples are well adapted to this atmosphere. For once, they are up to date. Sometimes people wonder that the native, rather than give his wife a dress, buys instead a transistor radio. There is no reason to be astonished. The natives are convinced that their fate is in the balance here and now. They live in the atmosphere of doomsday, and they consider that nothing ought to be let pass unnoticed. That is why they understand very well Foma and Fomi, Lumumba and Tshombe, Aijo and Maumee, Kenyatta, and the men who are pushed forward regularly to replace him. They understand all these figures very well, for they can unmask the forces working behind them. The native and the underdeveloped man are today political animals in the most universal sense of the word. It is true to say that independence has brought moral compensation to colonized peoples and has established their dignity. But they have not yet had time to elaborate a society or to build up and affirm values. The warming, light-giving center where man and citizen develop and enrich their experience in wider and still wider fields does not yet exist. Set in a kind of irresolution, such men persuade themselves fairly easily that everything is going to be decided elsewhere, for everybody at the same time. As for the political leaders, when faced with this situation, they first hesitate and then choose neutralism. There is plenty to be said on the subject of neutralism. Some equate it with a sort of tainted mercantilism which consists of taking what it can get from both sides. In fact, neutralism, a state of affairs created by the Cold War, if it allows underdeveloped countries to receive economic help from both sides, does not allow either party to aid underdeveloped areas to the extent that is necessary. Those literally astronomical sums of money which are invested in military research, those engineers who are transformed into technicians of nuclear war, could in the space of 15 years raise the standard of living of underdeveloped countries by 60%. So we see that the true interests of underdeveloped countries do not lie in the protraction nor in the accentuation of this Cold War. but it so happens that no one asks their advice. Therefore, when they can, they cut loose from it. But can they really remain outside it? At this very moment, France is trying out her atomic bombs in Africa. Apart from the passing of motions, the holding of meetings, and the shattering of diplomatic relations, we cannot say that the peoples of Africa have had much influence in this particular sector on France's attitude. Neutralism produces in the citizen of the third world a state of mind which is expressed in everyday life by fearlessness and an ancestral pride strangely resembling defiance. The flagrant refusal to compromise and the tough will that sets itself against getting tied up are reminiscent of the behavior of proud, poverty-stricken adolescents who are always ready to risk their necks in order to have the last word. All this leaves Western observers dumbfounded. For to tell the truth, there is a glaring divergence between what these men claim to be and what they have behind them. These countries without tramways, without troops, and without money have no justification for the bravado that they display in broad daylight. Undoubtedly, they are impostors. The Third World often gives the impression that it rejoices in sensation and that it must have its weekly dose of crises. These men at the head of empty countries who talk too loud are most irritating. You like to shut them up. But, on the contrary, they are in great demand. They are given bouquets. They are invited to dinner. In fact, we quarrel over who shall have them. And this is neutralism. They are 98% illiterate, but they are the subject of a huge body of literature. They travel a great deal. The governing classes and students of undeveloped countries are gold mines for airline companies. African and Asian officials may in the same month follow a course on socialist planning in Moscow and one on the advantages of the liberal economy in London or at Columbia University. African trade union leaders leap ahead at a great rate in their own field. Hardly have they been appointed to post in managerial organizations than they decide to form themselves into autonomous bodies. They haven't the requisite 50 years' experience of practical trade unionism in the framework of an industrial country, but they already know that non-political trade unionism doesn't make sense. They haven't come to grips with the bourgeois machine, nor developed their consciousness in the class struggle. But perhaps this isn't necessary. Perhaps. We shall see that this will, to sum everything up, which caricatures itself often in facile internationalism, is one of the most fundamental characteristics of underdeveloped countries. Let us return to considering the single combat between native and settler. We have seen that it takes the form of an armed and open struggle. There is no lack of historical examples. Indochina, Indonesia, and of course, North Africa. But what we must not lose sight of is that this struggle could have broken out anywhere. In Guinea, as well as Somaliland, and moreover today, it could break out in every place where colonialism means to stay on. In Angola, for example. The existence of an armed struggle shows that the people are decided to trust to violent methods only. He of whom they have never stopped saying that the only language he understands is that of force, decides to give utterance by force. In fact, as always, the settler has shown him the way he should take if he is to become free. The argument the native chooses has been furnished by the settler, and by an ironic turning of the tables, it is the native who now affirms that the colonialist understands nothing but force. The colonial regime owes its legitimacy to force, and in no time tries to hide this aspect of things. Every statue, whether of Fidèbe or Lyautey or Bourgeois, or of Sergeant Blandin, all these conquistadors perched on colonial soil do not cease from proclaiming one and the same thing. Quote, "We are here by the force of bayonets." The sentence is easily completed. During the phase of insurrection, each settler reasons on a basis of simple arithmetic. This logic does not surprise the other settlers, but it is important to point out that it does not surprise the natives either. To begin with, the affirmation of the principle, "it's them or us," does not constitute a paradox, since colonialism, as we have seen, is in fact the organization of a Manichaean world, a world divided up into compartments, and when in laying down precise methods, the settler asks each member of the oppressing minority to shoot down 30 or 100 or 200 natives. He sees that nobody shows any indignation, and that the whole problem is to decide whether it can be done all at once or by stages. The chain of reasoning, which presumes very arithmetically the disappearance of the colonized people, does not leave the native overcome with moral indignation. He has always known that his duel with the settler would take place in the arena. The native loses no time in lamentations, and he hardly ever seeks for justice in the colonial framework. The fact is that if the settler's logic leaves the native unshaken, it is because the latter has practically stated the problem of his liberation in identical terms. We must form ourselves into groups of 200 or 500, and each group must deal with a settler. It is in this manner of thinking that each of the protagonists begins the struggle. For the native, this violence represents the absolute line of action. The militant is also a man who works. The questions that the organization asks the militant bear the mark of this way of looking at things. Where have you worked? With whom? What have you accomplished? The group requires that each individual perform an irrevocable action. In Algeria, for example, where almost all the men who called on the people to join in the national struggle were condemned to death or searched for by the French police, confidence was proportional to the hopelessness of each case. You could be sure of a new recruit when he could no longer go back into the colonial system. This mechanism, it seems, had existed in Kenya among the Mau Mau, who required that each member of the group should strike a blow at the victim. Each one was thus personally responsible for the death of that victim. To work means to work for the death of the settler. This assumed responsibility for violence allows both strayed and outlawed members of the group to come back again and to find their place once more, to become integrated. Violence is thus seen as comparable to a royal pardon. The colonized man finds his freedom in and through violence. This rule of conduct enlightens the agent because it indicates to him the means and the end. The poetry of Césaire takes on in this precise aspect of violence a prophetic significance. We may recall one of the most decisive pages of his tragedy, where the rebel, indeed, explains his conduct. The rebel, harshly. "My name, an offense. My Christian name, humiliation. My status, a rebel. My age, the Stone Age. The mother. My race, the human race. My religion, brotherhood. The rebel. My race, that of the fallen. My religion. But it's not you that will show it to me with your disarmament. It's I myself, with my rebellion and my poor fist clenched and my woolly head. I remember one November day, it was hardly 6 months ago, the master came into the cabin in a cloud of smoke like an April moon. He was flexing his short, muscular arms. He was a very good master. And he was rubbing his little dimpled face with his fat fingers. His blue eyes were smiling, and he couldn't get the honey words out of his mouth quick enough. "The kid will be a decent fellow," he said, looking at me. And he said other pleasant things, too. "The master, that you had to start very early. That 20 years was not too much to make a good Christian and a good slave, a steady, devoted boy. A good commander's chain gang captain, sharp-eyed and strong-armed. And all that man saw of my son's cradle was that it was the cradle of a chain gang captain. We crept in, knife in hand." The mother. "Alas, you'll die for it." The rebel. "Killed? I killed him with my own hands. Yes, it was a fruitful death, a copious death. It was night. We crept among the sugar canes. The knives sang to the stars, but we did not heed the stars. The sugar canes scarred our faces with streams of green blades." The mother. "And I dreamed of a son to close his mother's eyes." The rebel. "But I chose to open my son's eyes upon another son. Oh, my son, son of evil and unlucky death. Mother of living and splendid death. Because he has hated too much. Because he has too much loved. Spare me, I am choking in your bonds. I bleed from your wounds. And the world does not spare me. There is not anywhere in the world a poor creature who's been lynched or tortured in whom I am not murdered and humiliated. God of heaven, deliver him. My heart, thou wilt not deliver me from all that I remember. It was an evening in November. And suddenly shouts lit up the silence. We had attacked, we the slaves, we the dung underfoot, we the animals with patient hooves. We were running like madmen, shots rang out. We were striking, blood and sweat cooled and refreshed us. We were striking where the shouts came from. And the shouts became more strident, and a great clamor rose from the east. It was the outhouses burning, and the flames flickered sweetly on our cheeks. Then was the assault made on the master's house. They were firing from the windows. We broke in the doors. The master's room was wide open. The master's room was brilliantly lighted, and the master was there, very calm. And our people stopped dead. It was the master. I went in. "It's you," he said, very calm. "It was I, even I, and I told him so, the good slave, the faithful slave, the slave of slaves." And suddenly his eyes were like two cockroaches frightened in the rainy season. I struck, and the blood spurted. That is the only baptism that I remember today. It is understandable that in this atmosphere, daily life becomes quite simply impossible. You can no longer be a fella, a pimp, or an alcoholic as before. The violence of the colonial regime and the counter-violence of the native balance each other and respond to each other in the extraordinary reciprocal homogeneity. This reign of violence will be the more terrible in proportion to the size of the implantation from the mother country. The development of violence among the colonized people will be proportionate to the violence exercised by the threatened colonial regime. In the first phase of this insurrectional period, the home governments are the slaves of the settlers, and these settlers seek to intimidate the natives and their home governments at one and the same time. They use the same methods against both of them. The assassination of the mayor of Evian, in its method and motivation, is identifiable with the assassination of Ali Boumangel. For the settlers, the alternative is not between Algerian and Algerie Francaise, but between an independent Algeria and a colonial Algeria, and anything else is mere talk or attempts at treason. The settlers' logic is implacable, and one is only staggered by the counter-logic visible in the behavior of the native, insofar as one has not clearly understood beforehand the mechanisms of the settlers' ideas. From the moment that the native has chosen the methods of counter-violence, police reprisals automatically call forth reprisals on the side of the nationalist. However, the results are not equivalent, for machine gunning from airplanes and bombardments from the fleet go far beyond in horror and magnitude any answer the natives can make. This recurring terror demystifies once and for all the most estranged members of the colonized race. They find out on the spot that all the piles of speeches on the equality of human beings do not hide the commonplace fact that the 7 Frenchmen killed or wounded at the Col de Sacmoti kindles the indignation of all civilized consciousness, whereas the sack of the Douars of Jorgor and of the Dekras of Jera and the massacre of whole populations, which had merely called forth the Sacamote ambush as a reprisal, all this is of not the slightest importance. Terror, counter-terror, violence, counter-violence. That is what observers bitterly record when they describe the circle of hate, which is so tenacious and so evident in Algeria.
Context of White Supremacy. That is the first study segment, France Fanon, the Wretched of the Earth. We'll pick up for me, let's see. For me, this would be kind of at the bottom of, it's like 90. Looks like we're at, for me, I guess that would be kind of at or midpoint of page 90. At any rate, context of white supremacy, I'll remind folks when we get ready for the second audio segment. If you have commentary you would like to share, the number to dial 641-715-3640. The code 564-943-pound. Press *6 if you would like to participate. Number again, 641-715-3640. The code 564-943-pound. Press *6 if you would like to participate. If you do not want to use your phone, you can also join in using the free VoIP line. It's linked in the description at Black Talk Radio Network. If you need the address, it is tinytiny.cc/oneRace. And that is the number one. Address again, tinytiny.cc/oneRace. When you enter that address, click the link on the left of the page. It should say free vote line. Click it. It will open a small window on your screen. The top line, it is a drop-down menu. Select the number I just gave out, which again is 641-715-3640. The next line, it will ask for a code. That code again is 564-943. Final line, it will ask for a name, real name, nickname, random keys, whatever you are comfortable sharing. Once you get that information entered, click the green button at the bottom. It'll connect you to the live broadcast. You should be able to hear us. Same procedure. You'll see the dial pad on your screen. If you would like to participate, press star 6, star 6-1, actually. And I'll see your hand on the screen. We'll be able to get you on the line. White people kill for fun. The words of the infamous Mr. Nero, longtime listener at the Cows. But his words hit me while listening to Frantz Fanon's work this week. White people kill for fun. With that, folks who dialed in with a hand up, line should be open. Proceed. Several folks with hand
up. I would have to.
Okay. We can hear you. Go ahead.
I would have to hold all of my comments. I came in late on the reading, and it's worse enough when you hear the whole reading on being able to comment. So I'll just right now listen, and maybe I can catch up by listening to whatever everybody else is saying, and I'll chime in sometime before the second reading.
Right on. Respect that, retired firefighter. We'll look out for you second time around. Other folks who dialed in with a hand up, do you all have commentary?
Yes, may I be heard?
Greetings, Mr. Demery Ford.
Yes, greetings, Gus. Greetings to the other callers and listeners. I missed last week's reading. I was on vacation. But I think what we see here is the writer, Frantz Fanon, went through a process himself, you know, being a doctor and also what he saw from both sides and, you know, the struggle of the Algerian people. But then when he starts to write, he says, the young colonized subject who grows up in the atmosphere of fire and brimstone has no scruples marking zombie ancestors, two-headed horses, corpses woken from the dead, and gens who take advantage of yarn slips inside the body. The colonized subject discovers reality and transforms it through his prism, his deployment of violence, and his agenda for liberation. So it's almost like each person has to come into a realization of what type of environment that you're in. And it may be difficult to realize the position as a colonized individual, you know, which most of us, all non-white people, would fall in that category. But then all of these symptoms that go along with being in that type of environment, the decolonization is the only solution. But then the book points out that how can you get a bunch of people together? How can you muster others to go along with you when they feel like that it's useless, that if you go up against something so powerful, you will most likely be annihilated. He pointed out some of these atrocities that happened across the globe, like Sharpsville and, you know, some of these horrific massacres that brought international attention. So it created like a Cold War. But what we have to be cautious of, the system itself will create a liberal front that will have you thinking that they're somewhat on your side, but they're playing you against the middle. In other words, exacting violence on you and then giving you a way to vent those frustrations through your leaders, like it was saying, that has no power whatsoever. And some of them may be even working with the colonialists or the people who are in power. So when I think it was good that he started out, because we already know that revolution or any type of change is going to have to come through violence. But then an individual change, you know, would be something revolutionary too, if you could come to a realization of what you're dealing with and understand, you know, what it is, what white supremacy racism is, then you would have a better chance on countering. He brought up too that said nowadays the governments of colonist countries know perfectly well that it's highly dangerous to deprive the masses of their leader. For it is then that the people hurl themselves headlong into jacques, mutinies, and bestial murders. So they even know what's going on. They exert this violence on you. Then when you come back with counter violence, they already got it figured out. We're going to allow your leaders to come up and quell your enthusiasm. And at the same time, double speech, because it was saying here, so they say the colonized want to move fast. And you hear that a lot. We still have a long way to go with racism. Racism exists, but we're moving along. We're making some progress. But it's just that the non-white people or black people want progress too fast. But then it said, let us never forget that it wasn't such a long time ago the colonized were accused of being too slow, lazy. And you know what I'm saying? It's double speak. So I'll mute my line and give somebody else a chance. I'll come back a little later with some of the other thoughts that I had. Thanks for taking the call, guys.
For sure. Mr. Demry Four, the smartest person on the call for sure. If he just got back from vacation last week, that is intelligent move right there. Other folks who dialed in with a hand up have commentary. Feel free.
Can I be heard?
Yes, ma'am.
Greetings, beautiful people. I was unable to participate in last week's reading, but I still had a couple of notes. Is it all right if I kind of just mention them just really quick?
Proceed.
Okay. So there's a part, I have the new translation and with, of course, totally different pages, but I read my new translation, but then I listen to the older translation. So they follow similar. So I'm sure certain words will pop out in let other folks know what I'm talking about based off of the new translation. But in the very beginning of his text, he mentioned that the colonized don't view themselves as animals. And I just had a question of whether or not that was true. I know here sometimes we're not really sure how we view ourselves, especially subconsciously. So it took me a while in the text to really realize, like, okay, he's not necessarily talking about African people displaced throughout the diaspora, particularly in the United States, that he is talking about people who are still on the continent. And I do think that there's just a little bit of a difference in terms of our subjugation and our terrorism and the level of what that looks like and what has happened to us given that process. Another thing, like, I'll get to that note, but he mentioned that 98% of the people who are being talked about are a little illiterate, the colonized. But then I kind of was like, well, if you know that, why'd you write the book like this? A book that's difficult for even people who are literate to kind of get through. I feel like there's a lot in this text that if I could just look at the words and let the most important stuff come up or kind of glow, that would be the point. Certain points are, you know, about the bourgeoisie, non-white people, like that's important and being traitors and such and such and such and, you know, coming to all that. That violence appears to be the primary mode of change that non-white people have at our disposal, that violence, as quote unquote violence, is our redemptive factor. Like that's what will correct all of these bad things that are going on. I feel like, you know, if you wanted to write it like this, you could also maybe have like a cliff note version or something like that. Like that just made it so that folks who aren't as literate as a medical doctor, psychiatrist would be able to understand. So I guess like he's writing this to the very same bourgeoisie people he's referring to. I think the text would also be a little bit clearer if we weren't talking in terms of colonized, colonialist, all of that, white, non-white, because that's essentially what we're saying. And that would make this, I think, much, much clearer. In terms of understanding what he's like talking about, because every, you know, when you hear every other word is colonized, colonial, all that kind of stuff, it's difficult to really understand what is being like said. But I also think that it's important that when he does address the bourgeoisie, non-white people, that he this quote, of course, will be different because I have a different translation. But he says, the intellectual sheds all that calculating, all those strange silences, ulterior motives, that devious thinking and secrecy as he gradually plunges deeper among the people. And I felt like that was accurate, that when you are indoctrinated into academia or pseudo or so-called intellectualism, that natural way of being kind of, you cast it off whether it is you are really trying to or not. And that being with people, you kind of get out of that thinking, that analytical, like linear way of being, which separates people who are not like that. So anyway, and he talks a little bit more about it, like he'll just move it on. I thought what he did have to say about the bourgeoisie non-white people was important. And I also appreciate it just because he doesn't dismiss them all the way and say that, he himself is one of these people. But a lot of times I observe that if you are like that, that disconnect, not only do you feel it, but the people that you want to be close to feel it, and it makes it difficult to really come together, but we need each other. Those of us who have been educated in academia and those who are educated and wise, like far wiser than people who are even like so-called intellectuals who have not been to college and stuff like that, we need each other, but it requires that, I think, the intellectual cease that way of being and get back to being, I don't know, I don't want to say human, but just regular, like cool, relaxed, able to be with people who aren't using these extra big words and this very fluffy language. He also said something about the splitting of the personality, which is interesting because a lot of times people will dismiss non-white people's traditional ways of assessing behavior. So when I hear split personality, I also hear possession, which is the same thing, to have two different personalities, individual, and that individual is in conflict. Do they want to be the type A person or the type B person? And I just thought, I was like, yes, now I can hear some of that psychiatry that you do. And I appreciated that he talks about zombies and stuff, but since I have limited time, he then goes to talk about the colonial population is a consumer market. And I think about that all the time because so many people want to, I think we want to believe that our formal enslavement ended because of the Civil War, for instance, or because white people were just tired of doing it. But to me, I think that they thought about it and they realized, look, we need people to buy these things. And that's why we're still here. Non-white people are here, is to purchase these things that white people produce corporations to produce. And we buy all of that stuff because we make up 9/10 of the population of the globe. So they need people to buy it. They themselves wouldn't be able to give themselves the same kind of economic uplift. They'd all be rich. They'd all have everything and nobody would really be buying anything. So you have to have us, the so-called not-haves in that whole capitalism. You know, you have the haves and the have-nots. You have to have the have-nots so that there can be the haves. And so we're not like slaves in that formal sense, but still enslaved. And that's all that like consumer market, Nikes, iPhones, Apple laptops, college, all of that, you know, cars, all of that stuff makes white people rich. And that's what they needed. They didn't need us that way anymore. I was very interested in the text, especially when I read the introduction, because I think that the conversation around violence is one that we must have. And why, I'm not really sure, because, you know, United, Independent, everyone can choose to do whatever it is that they're going to do. But by not addressing it, I think that from my understanding of the text, he understands that to be part of what is fueling psychotic breaks or psychological breakdowns. And he says, but let us return to the atmospheric violence, this violence rippling under the skin. And I was, you know, if it's there, and when we're honest with ourselves, when I'm honest with myself, and we just think about it, it's there. So if you don't act the violence, like if you, you know, that's what that whole glitchy, that shaking, that anxiety, that stress, when that white person, like all of that stuff, if it doesn't come out, it comes out in cancer, high blood pressure, diabetes, aneurysms, strokes, heart disease. So in part, I feel like the addressing of the violence speaking honestly about it is part of psychological health. Let's see here. I'll try to be quick. There's another part where he talks about the colonialist or the citizen of the third world, is what my text says, that this staunch refusal to compromise, the sheer determination to go it alone, recall the behavior of those deprived, self-centered teenagers who are always prepared to fight to the last over a mere word. All of this disconcerts Western observers, for there is, strictly speaking, a scandalous discrepancy between what these men claim to be and what, in fact, they have to back them up. These countries without urban transportation, without troops, without money, cannot justly flaunting such bravado. It is without doubt an imposture. And I feel that exact same. The loudest one in the room is the one who's most insecure. And so whenever I see that behavior in mass of non-white people, I interpret that white people understand that. It is only in my interpretation, my opinion, that when we are quiet and when we are deliberate and when we are serious, that we really make them afraid. But when we're loud, when we're yelling, when we're doing all of that stuff, everybody understands that you're insecure, you don't have nothing, and you ain't about nothing. Like, what are you going to do? Because if you really were serious, like, if you really could, why would you be doing all that? I don't think in this text that they read the footnotes, but there's a footnote in my text for when... I don't know how to even describe it since we have different translations, but essentially the footnote says that white people have not and will not kill us all off because they're more committed to domination than in my interpretation of this. And I won't read that whole thing because limited time. But it says, I'll read it just so you all can hear it. It is obvious that this general cleanup destroys the one thing one wants to save. This is exactly what Sartre indicates when he says, and then there's this long quote that I'm not going to read, but my interpretation of that is that's the reason, like maybe over time, yeah, they'll want to go ahead and cut us down, get us to the point that we are like negatively, like we're not positively producing that much people. But that is, and for my interpretation is I'm coming to it mainly because they're more committed to dominating. Like if they had nobody else to dominate, then they would self-destruct. And then violence can thus be understood to be the perfect mediation. And I kind of think it's also the perfect meditation, although that's weird. Like sometimes I'm not even gonna lie to y'all. I'll sit here and I wonder what it was like to be in Haiti when they won. Like that had to have been, I don't even know. I'm sure it was tears, parties, like the craziest feeling in the world to have won. Now, of course, they suffer now, but in that moment, that night, maybe they're sitting on the beach, the moon is lit, like, it's the, like, you don't even have words. You're probably just so overcome with the fact that this is what has happened. So, at any rate, that the colonized man liberates himself in and through violence, and I'm not advocating violence, but I'm just saying there's no denying what these people have done, what white people have done. And for us not to say, like, look, you know what I mean? And what they continue to do, violence is just something that is on the table that should be discussed, or counterbalance, whatever terminology makes people feel better. Then in the midst of it is poetry, when the mother says from too much hate and the rebel says from too much love. And I understand that it's not hate that is making me or anybody else who's having these kind of conversations feel like this is what we have to have, that it is a love for the non-white people, a love for yourself that makes you say, look, enough is enough. I'm willing to die for it today, tonight. Let's go. Like, it's done. These people have done too much. Like, even now, it's done. Like, they could do no more to this day. Like, today, like, be like, I'll never kill another non-white person. And it's not enough. It's not enough. Moving on. And then when he said that was his baptism, I was just like, wow, yeah, I'll wrap it up. And I just thought that that was potent, that, you know, that's the only baptism he could remember was when he killed his so-called master. So, all right, thank you.
Appreciate it, Emmy, chiming in, nation's capital or DMV area. Other folks that we've not heard from, anybody with a hand up that we've not heard from, have commentary? We miss anybody, or we got all the folks who had a hand up?
Can I be heard?
Yes, ma'am.
Okay. Greetings to everyone on the line. I as well was not able to participate in the previous study session, but I have read the session before, so I'm just going to try to sum up what I have marked down. Starting from kind of the beginning, I felt like I was also basically the whole entire like Ferguson situation and Mike Brown's killing has been on my mind, of course, as it is a, I guess what they call it, an anniversary of sorts. But I felt like I was being reminded of that whole period at the beginning of this week's first session. It comes to mind particularly because I was listening to Roland Martin's podcast recently, and apparently there's like a new documentary out about Ferguson and such. And so the part where they're saying, basically the first couple paragraphs we read this week, where they're talking about how so-called leaders come out with no real steps or plan. He says that this translation says there is a vague outline or skeleton which describes minimum requirements. They avoid the actual overthrowing of the state, but in fact they introduce into their readers or hearers' consciousness the terrible ferment of subversion. That just kind of, I don't know, it resonated with me and it brought to mind the entire way it seems to happen. Like it's like a formula almost, like, okay, there's an unjust killing, which in and of itself is an oxymoron. Then there's the unrest, some so-called leaders come out, and then there's the calming down. So this whole first portion of this week's reading kind of just really resonated with that in me. Also, I thought of how he, this translation at least brought it, made it clear to me that not only is he saying how it affects the so-called colonized, which I, whenever I see that word, I just replace it with non-white or victim of racism. And it's the part where he says not a single colonized individual could ever again doubt the possibility of a Dion or Dian Phu. That portion where he says this encompassing violence does not work upon the colonized people only. It modifies the attitude of the colonialists who become aware of manifold Dian Bien Phu's. What I took from that was basically whenever we do have these situations of unrest, uprising, whatever you want to call it, basically white people are sitting back taking notes and saying, like, okay, how can we basically further refine our reaction to this? How can we bring these about to be profitable for us? Like, you know, just basically they're sitting back taking notes and we're just marching. And something else that I wanted to speak on was the portion about the spokesman, or again, I guess the leaders. I found it interesting where he says, I'm sorry, trying to find it. Yeah, the authorities do in fact take some spectacular measures. They arrest one or two leaders. They organize military parades and maneuvers and Air Force displays. Again, just all of that kind of just brought to mind again. It has already been in my mind, but the entire situation that happened in Ferguson, among many other areas recently. Basically, it's the part where he said, where they, the translation states that the colonialists, or again, I would place that with white people, they will take, you know, the leaders and they'll release them with, you know, due to the cries of the colonizers, the victims of racism. They'll release them, they'll hold discussions with them, and then the time for the dancing in the streets has come. Basically, and the one person that kind of really popped in my mind with that entire sentence was Nelson Mandela, and how, you know, he was in prison, he comes out of prison and he becomes president. That just popped into my head. But I found that interesting, that because I see that as a repetitive tool as well. Okay, we give you this person to look to, and they do exactly what it says in the book about, as a general rule, colonialism welcomes this godsend with open arms, transforms these blind mouths into spokesmen, and in 2 minutes endows them with independence on condition that they restore order, basically just to keep victims of racism in line, keep them in line as much as possible with the plan that we have set forth. That is pretty much all that I had taken notes on, because I was in and out, unfortunately. But what I felt like could sum this all up is, for me at least, something that Mr. Fuller says is that, unfortunately, we will not defeat white supremacy until we begin to value justice over existence. And I think that also includes moving past violence as a response, because something that he said towards the end of this first portion of the reading, it's like, you know, just violence begets counterviolence, and it's just going to continue to be a cycle. And at this point, I'm not entirely sure exactly how much violence the 9/10 of the world is able to inflict on that 1%, considering how much they have invested in making sure that they are militarily superior to anybody else. So, I think that, you know, once you begin to value justice over existence, you begin to think a little bit more out of the box of what is usually prescribed. And I think violence is an easy go-to. I think we have to think bigger than that. And that will hopefully open the door to ending this horrible system. But that's all I had. I'll meet my line. Thank you for listening.
Mm-hmm. Appreciate that. If other folks had commentary they wanted to get in, raise a hand and we will get you online as well. Some of the comments that I had from the first portion of the audio, number one, I would repeat Mr. Nero's words, white people kill for fun. As we read this week, that came to mind, and this is as long as we're reading the book until the conclusion, listeners can be thinking about and maybe responding to, why is this book so popular amongst a large segment of whites? This is one of their go-to books. Oh, yeah. France Fanon tells it like it is. Great book, or great books. A lot of times they'll, you know, have the whole catalog. Why is it that white people like and even often promote Fanon's work? Why is that in a system of racism, white supremacy? Mr. Nero's words, I think that's one reason. It's been my experience, and this was not my original way of thinking. This happened with some influence from Mr. Fuller. He's talked about this before. And then just studying history more, it's my experience. White people, they love, absolutely love violence, particularly if it's going to be violence against black people. I think one of our callers can appreciate the great thespian Ice-T's film, Surviving the Game, where they make a sport out of killing, particularly killing black people. They love this sort of thing, like whoopee, like get the foxes and horses right on. That's not, you know, Ferguson, right on. I had been waiting to get my tank and my new nigger knocker. Yes, get the opportunity to kill a few black people. I strongly suspect that alone would be reason why whites would enjoy and promote this book. Yes, let's get the black people riled up and thinking, yes, we are going to kill us some crackers and woo, we will go to town. This is great. Yes, I actually think that could be a major reason why white people promote this book. Also, it's not even that I'm, you know, shrugging off violence. That's great. White people have done a lot to discourage us from being violent, awarding non-white people victims of white supremacy who said that the only way we can solve this problem is through nonviolence, awarding and promoting them at times. And other people around the world for promoting and saying nonviolence. You know, we got to be nice and, you know, win over whites and make them love us and stop practicing racism that way. Sometimes they do that. At other times, just say, hey, we like a good fight. We love it. And we particularly love mopping the floor with niggers. So get whatever, you know, rowdy spokesperson you want to talk about killing black people. And, you know, let's get down. And in fact, he mentions the Mau Maus in Kenya a lot. And this is a book I think you would get more out of the more you know about some of the people that are being mentioned. Aimé César, the poem that he reads from, if you know more about him and some of the Vietnam conflict, if you know more about these folks, you probably have a deeper appreciation for the text. But he talks about the Mau Mau conflict and how, you know, that inspired some damage in terms of white rule, colonial domination, and made them want to push for decolonization. The Mau Maus, and this was a group of black people in Kenya who were committed to armed counterviolence to, and this would be the British, quote unquote, British whites who were in Kenya. I think there's scholarship, Esther Stanford Kosei. She's a black female in the UK. She's been a guest on the program. She's done work with some of the black people in Kenya. They got reparations just for the white supremacist violence in response to the Mau Maus, not colonialism, not what the British had done in Kenya and through all the decades and years of dominating black people, just for their violent response to the Mau Maus. I think the ratio was something like, for every one white person that the Mau Maus killed, the colonial arm of white supremacy would kill like 10 black people. So, I mean, if you just follow that math, you kill 100 white people, and I don't think they got that high.
1,000 black people. I know they got real high. I know at least fine. I mean, you know how whites do. It's going to be whatever. If we can't get a Mau Mau, fine. We'll just find 10 other niggas and, you know, call it one. Might even be 20. Depends on how much coffee I had today. That's what happens, generally speaking. It's not anything to brag about. If you, maybe we should do that. If you go, in my view, if you go and study what happened with that, I don't think it's one where you can jump up and down and be like, oh yeah, this was a victory. We show those white people, you know, what for? We made them get out of town quick, man. Don't ever step foot back in Kenya again, you know, Barack Obama or anybody else you want to visit. That is not the case from my understanding. Anywho, again, and they got reparations just for the counterviolent response, the way white people responded to the Mau Maus. They gave up reparations for that and acknowledged, wow, that was, you know, we did do y'all kind of rough in our response. Moving forward to the actual text and things that stood out, where he mentioned, I already mentioned this, the more you know about these people, when he mentions these different names, Sundiata, Samori, Abdel Kader, I don't even know who all these folks are. That would take separate time to research and kind of figure out more. Just something I always encourage in reading. That's the purpose of reading, to learn. The text where he says, I think our previous caller, female caller, mentioned this, where he says, all these repressive measures, all those actions, which are a result of fear, are not within the leader's intentions. They are overtaken by events. At this moment, then, colonialism may decide to arrest the nationalist leaders. But today, the governments of colonized countries know very well that it is extremely dangerous to deprive the masses of their leaders. Stop. I think that's a false statement. And this is one of those, I think we minimize the power. If he's talking about white people, when he says colonialism, governments of colonized countries, racist man, racist woman, racist child. For this time period, 1961, when this book was published, I would say that is a false statement. Just in that period, they just killed Patrice Lumumba, mentioned in this book. They just killed him. Democratically elected leader, and they deprived them of their leader. And in fact, not just locked him up, killed him, dismembered the body. You're not even going to have a funeral. Take that for your decolonized Congo. I didn't see retribution. I didn't see, you know, folks going to stomp down white people and, you know, kill up a whole bunch of folks. Maybe that happened. It was not reported, but I just don't see the evidence of that. And I mean, there's tons of black people, non-white people all over the world. You see that every day. You just said the anniversary of Michael Brown. But I mean, if you want to talk leaders specifically from that time period, we don't have enough time on this program to talk about the number of black and non-white people from that period who were locked up, beaten, killed, or whatever else. And that's just that, whatever we feel like doing for the day. Doesn't matter how many black people get upset and stomp around in the street. At the end of the day, we are in charge, period. So I think that is a false statement. Important to point that sort of thing out, in my view. Continuing, for then the people, unbridled, fling themselves into jacqueries, mutinies, and brutish murders. These masses give free rein to their bloodthirsty instincts and force colonialism to free their leaders, to whom falls the difficult task of bringing them back to order. I would like an itemized list, because I don't know if this is like fiction. I don't know if this is metaphor. I would like halt. I want a footnote, and I want exact places where this happened. And I'm very, very, very sure, bad back and all, that that list is going to be real, real small in comparison to the list of times that racist man, racist woman, racist child have snatched any number of non-white leaders anywhere in the universe and caged them, beat them, castrated them, raped them, or whatever else they wanted. Even Nelson Mandela, they held him for 30 years. People had protested and yelled all over the world, we'll release him when we're ready to. And that's what colonialism, aka white supremacy, means. We cannot short shirk that. And this sort of thing stands out big to me in a text that is widely praised as being great. When you have those type, I mean, that's a major error, in my opinion. You can't be giving out bad information, false information about racism, white supremacy. Continuing. Mm.
metaphors. He has a lot of metaphors. I've mentioned that before in the text. I'm really not a fan of having lots and lots of metaphors in a reading about racism, white supremacy. I think we need specifics. I think, and he even mentions that in the text. He had a passage where he touched on that. I'll get to it later. I had a lot of notes. I will not read them all because I see other hands as well. Let's see. Where the portion I thought it was very important when he said, for what Mr. Khrushchev shows the colonized countries which are looking on is that he, the Mujik, who moreover is the possessor of space rockets, treats these miserable capitalists in the way that they deserve. He's talking about him being in front of the UN, thumping his shoe on the table. For whatever reason, I remembered immediately the thought that flashed in my mind was George Bush having to dodge that shoe, but neither here nor there. To me, this just seems like more major confusion. It's been my experience. White racist man, racist woman, racist child, they absolutely adore being able to, contrary to what he says, it's been my experience that whites, they love pushing all sorts of false concepts on black people. It's not racism. It's capitalism. You should be a socialist. You should be a communist. You should be a Marxist-Leninist. They love that sort of thing. We got tons of them up here in Seattle. Now, maybe that was not the case in the 60s, although they had the Student for Democratic Society. They worked with the Black Panther Party that was mentioned in Mumia's clip. You had whites like that back then. So I'm not even sure that it's the case to just say that that's a new aspect. I think you had white people. We had one on the program, Bill Ayers, from Students for Democratic Society. He was with that group. I think you had that sort of thing then. The Black Panthers, they gave out a lot of those little red books. Talking about capitalist pigs and all that. Whites do, and contrary to what he says in the text about them, whites, colonialists, not wanting those ideas to seep into the minds of black people. Maybe that was the case on the continent in Africa. I just don't think it's the case. It's been my experience. Anything that will push you away from thinking, wait a minute, the problem is white people. That's what it is. They are at the core of all of this, whether they call themselves Christians, whether they call themselves socialists, whether they were born in Britain, whether they were born in Australia, wherever they happen to be at, they are the problem for non-white people, especially black people. They will push you away from any way of thinking about what's happening on the planet, anything to get you away from that, which in my view is the truth. Anything else? I'll get our other caller. He had one or two other passages that I thought were really important as well. And I guess the only other thing I'll say, I think it's very important. Perhaps there was not as much literature at the time this book was published in 1961 to evidence that black people have concluded centuries ago, counterviolence might be needed to deal with whites. So let's get to it. I mean, we've talked about that. That's in many of the books that we've read. Apparently, Gil Scott Heron was trafficking guns. We just didn't get enough information about that in the last book that we read. Edward Baptist, The Half Has Never Been Told. He had lots of black people who had already come to this conclusion more than 150 years before Wretched of the Earth was published. I know a lot of black people are not familiar with that. Whites have been extremely successful at burying the Haitian Revolution and the other myriads of times that the Mau Maus and other black people who have fought back and used violence and killed lots of black people, a lot of that information has been successfully hidden by whites. So I guess for a lot of people, that's news. They didn't know about Robert F. Williams and all these other folks, but that was not new. You had black people, even he mentions that in the text, that it was almost as though black people had just started to come to this notion of self-defense. And that is not true at all. We will shoot back. We've had tons of texts on the program talking about that long history of black people who've already come to that conclusion and are practicing counterviolence, where at minimum self-defense, including Rosa Parks' family. Talked about that as well. So I think that's also important, or at least something that came to mind to me. The caller that dialed in, 5771. Did you have commentary? 5771.
Yes, can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Okay, came in late, didn't get a chance to take notes, but I wanted to emphasize one of the reasons that and you mentioned this, Gus, in regards to why this book is popular is because of this chapter of violence on violence, the chapter on violence. Most of the other chapters in this book is like almost totally ignored, because when I hear white people write and talk about, you know, this book, it's always on the first chapter of On Violence. And there is a documentary out there called, I don't know if it was mentioned already, but it was a documentary on there called Concerning Violence by a white, I think he's Swedish director, Gorlan Olsen. And he did the documentary, particularly on this chapter. You know, another white person, big Frantz Fanon fan, you know, of this book. So that was that's very interesting in regards to the popularity of why this book is you know, is popular among white people. So I just wanted to add that in.
For sure, for sure. We are going to get to the second audio segment. I know other folks had comments. Oh, I guess we do have time. We have about 5 minutes. If folks can be concise, you can get about 60 seconds. Well, depends on how much people have to say. So other folks have commentary they want to get in. We have about 5 minutes.
Yes, Robbie Hood.
Yes, sir.
Okay. I wanted to mention that he calls out the United States. In part of the reading, I don't know if I'll be able to find it, but he was talking about the Western. And that's where the confusion about capitalism may have come in. But also, I mentioned something about France testing an atomic bomb in Africa, even allowing for the resolution, the meetings and slamming of the doors on diplomatic relations. It cannot be said that the African people have much impact on France's attitude in this particular sector. So it just goes to show, even though, even if they do want to test a nuclear weapon in Africa, even if they do, what can the Africans do about it? It's the powerlessness of non-white black people in the system of white supremacy. I'm your brother.
Great point. I had that portion highlighted as well. The section, just really quickly, where he says the nationalist leaders know that international opinion is formed solely by the Western white press. Now, when a journalist from the West asks a question, it is seldom in order to help us. In the Algerian War, for example, even the most liberal of the French reporters never cease to use ambiguous terms in describing our struggle. Direct tactic of racism, white supremacy, in my opinion. I don't know if he perceived it in that way, because that's not the way that he's phrasing it, but this is not liberal white journalists. This is just how whites practice racism with the words that they use. Major weapon of white supremacy. Continuing, he says, when we reproached them for this, they replied in all good faith they were being objective, for the native objectivity is always directed against him. That portion I thought was very important and reminded me explicitly Dr. Marimba Ani. She came to the same conclusion. She might have even referenced Fanon, but a great section in her book Yoruga, where she talks about, comes to the exact same conclusion that whites lie big time when they come claiming, oh, we're just being objective, just, you know, trying to cover all sides fairly. That's normally what they'll say. I'm just trying to cover all sides fairly. Anybody else have commentary they need to get in? I thought Emmy said she had additional commentary. She might have bailed on us. Everyone satisfied? If that is the case, we can go ahead and get to the second audio. That's what we shall do. If folks have additional comments you didn't get to share, just write them down, take a note, and we should have time. Once the second audio concludes, we are still in the first chapter concerning violence. This is Frantz Fanon's Wretched of the Earth, context of white supremacy, audio segment number 2.
In all armed struggles, there exists what we might call the point of no return. Almost always, it is marked off by a huge and all-inclusive repression, which engulfs all sectors of the colonized people. This point was achieved in Algeria in 1955. with the 12,000 victims of Felipeville, and in 1956 with La Costa's instituting of urban and rural militias. Then it became clear to everybody, including even the settlers, that things couldn't go on as before. Yet the colonized people do not chalk up the reckoning. They record the huge gaps made in their ranks as a sort of necessary evil. Since they have decided to reply by violence, they therefore are ready to take all its consequences. They only insist in return that no reckoning should be kept either for the others. To the saying, "All natives are the same," the colonized person replies, "All settlers are the same." When the native is tortured, when his wife is killed or raped, he complains to no one. The oppressor's government can set up commissions of inquiry and of information daily if it wants to. In the eyes of the native, these commissions do not exist. The fact is that soon we shall have had 7 years of crimes in Algeria, and there has not yet been a single Frenchman indicted before a French court of justice for the murder of an Algerian. In Indochina, in Madagascar, or in the colonies, the native has always known that he need expect nothing from the other side. The settler's work is to make even dreams of liberty impossible for the native. The native's work is to imagine all possible methods for destroying the settler. On the logical plane, the Manichaeism of the settler produces a Manichaeism of the native. To the theory of the absolute evil of the native, the theory of the absolute evil of the settler replies. The appearance of the settler has meant, in the terms of syncretism, the death of the aboriginal society, cultural lethargy, and the petrification of individuals. For the native, life can only spring up again out of the rotting corpse of the settler. This, then, is the correspondence, term by term, between the two trains of reasoning. But it so happens that for the colonized people, this violence, because it constitutes their only work, invests their characters with positive and creative qualities. The practice of violence binds them together as a whole, since each individual forms a violent link in the great chain, a part of the great organism of violence which has surged upward in reaction to the settlers' violence in the beginning. The groups recognize each other, and the future nation is already indivisible. The armed struggle mobilizes the people. That is to say, it throws them in one way and in one direction. The mobilization of the masses, when it arises out of the war of liberation, introduces into each man's consciousness the ideas of a common cause, of a national destiny, and of a collective history. In the same way, the second phase, that of the building up of the nation, is helped on by the existence of this cement, which has been mixed with blood and anger. Thus we come to a fuller appreciation of the originality of the words used in these underdeveloped countries. During the colonial period, the people are called upon to fight against oppression. After national liberation, they are called upon to fight against poverty, illiteracy, and underdevelopment. The struggle, they say, goes on. The people realize that life is an unending contest. We have said that the native's violence unifies the people. By its very structure, colonialism is separatist and regionalist. Colonialism does not simply state the existence of tribes. It also reinforces it and separates them. The colonial system encourages chieftaincies and keeps alive the old marabout confraternities. Violence is an action all-inclusive and national. It follows that it is closely involved in the liquidation of regionalism and of tribalism. Thus, the national parties show no pity at all toward the Cades and the customary chiefs. Their destruction is the preliminary to the unification of the people. At the level of individuals, violence is a cleansing force. It frees the native from his inferiority complex and from his despair and inaction. It makes him fearless and restores his self-respect. Even if the armed struggle has been symbolic and the nation is demobilized through a rapid movement of decolonization, the people have the time to see that the liberation has been the business of each and all, and that the leader has no special merit. From thence comes that type of aggressive reticence with regard to the machinery of protocol which young governments quickly show. When the people have taken violent part in the national liberation, they will allow no one to set themselves up as quote-unquote liberators. They show themselves to be jealous of the results of their action and take good care not to place their future, their destiny, or the fate of their country in the hands of a living God. Yesterday, they were completely irresponsible. Today, they mean to understand everything and make all decisions. Illuminated by violence, the consciousness of the people rebels against any pacification. From now on, the demagogues, the opportunists, and the magicians have a difficult task. The action which has thrown them into a hand-to-hand struggle confers upon the masses a voracious taste for the concrete. The attempt at mystification becomes, in the long run, practically impossible. Violence in the international context. We have pointed out many times in the preceding pages that in undeveloped regions, the political leader is forever calling on his people to fight against colonialism, to fight against poverty and undevelopment, and to fight against sterile traditions. The vocabulary which he uses in his appeals is that of a chief of staff. Quote, mass mobilization, agricultural front, fight against illiteracy, defeats we have undergone, victories won. The young independent nation evolves during the first years in an atmosphere of the battlefield. For the political leader of an undeveloped country looks fearfully at the huge distance his country will have to cover. He calls to the people and says to them, let us gird up our loins and set to work. And the country, possessed by a kind of creative madness, throws itself into a gigantic and disproportionate effort. The program consists not only of climbing out of the morass, but also of catching up with the other nations, using the only means at hand. They reason that if the European nations have reached that stage of development, it is on account of their efforts. Let us, therefore, they seem to say, prove to ourselves and to the whole world that we are capable of the same achievements. This manner of setting out the problem of the evolution of underdeveloped countries seems to us to be neither correct nor reasonable. The European states achieved national unity at a moment when the national middle classes had concentrated most of the wealth in their hands. Shopkeepers and artisans, clerks and bankers monopolized finance, trade, and science in the national framework. The middle class was the most dynamic and prosperous of all classes. Its coming to power enabled it to undertake certain very important speculations. Industrialization, the development of communications, and soon the search for outlets overseas. In Europe, apart from certain slight differences, England, for example, was some way ahead, the various states were at a more or less uniform stage economically when they achieved national unity. There was no nation which, by reason of the character of its development and evolution, caused affront to the others. Today, national independence and the growth of national feeling in underdeveloped regions take on totally new aspects. In these regions, With the exception of certain spectacular advances, the different countries show the same absence of infrastructure. The mass of the people struggle against the same poverty, flounder about, making the same gestures, and with their shrunken bellies outline what has been called the geography of hunger. It is an underdeveloped world, a world inhuman in its poverty, but also it is a world without doctors, without engineers, and without administrators. Confronting this world, the European nations sprawl, ostentatiously opulent. This European opulence is literally scandalous, for it has been founded on slavery. It has been nourished with the blood of slaves, and it comes directly from the soil and from the subsoil of that underdeveloped world. The well-being and the progress of Europe have been built up with the sweat and the dead bodies of Negroes, Arabs, Indians, and the yellow races. We have decided not to overlook this any longer. When a colonialist country, embarrassed by the claims for independence made by a colony, proclaims to the nationalist leaders, "If you wish for independence, take it and go back to the Middle Ages," the newly independent people tend to acquiesce and to accept the challenge. In fact, you may see colonialism withdrawing its capital and its technicians and setting up around the young state the apparatus of economic pressure. The apotheosis of independence is transformed into the curse of independence, and the colonial power, through its immense resources of coercion, condemns the young nation to regression. In plain words, the colonial power says, "Since you want independence, take it and starve." The nationalist leaders have no other choice but to turn to their people and ask from them a gigantic effort. A regime of austerity is imposed on these starving men. A disproportionate amount of work is required from their atrophied muscles. An autarkic regime is set up, and each state, with the miserable resources it has in hand, tries to find an answer to the nation's great hunger and poverty. We see the mobilization of a people which toils to exhaustion in front of a suspicious and bloated Europe. Other countries of the Third World refuse to undergo this ordeal and agree to get over it by accepting the conditions of the former guardian power. These countries use their strategic position, a position which accords them privileged treatment in the struggle between the two blocs, to conclude treaties and give undertakings. The former dominated country becomes an economically dependent country. The ex-colonial power, which has kept intact and sometimes even reinforced its colonialist trade channels, agrees to provision the budget of the independent nation by small injections. Thus we see that the accession to independence of the colonial countries places an important question before the world. For the national liberation of colonized countries unveils their true economic state and makes it seem even more unendurable. The fundamental duel, which seemed to be that between colonialism and anti-colonialism, and indeed between capitalism and socialism, is already losing some of its importance. What counts today, the question which is looming on the horizon, is the need for a redistribution of wealth. Humanity must reply to this question, or be shaken to pieces by it. It might have been generally thought that the time had come for the world, and particularly for the Third World, to choose between the capitalist and socialist systems. The underdeveloped countries, which have used the fierce competition which exists between the two systems in order to assure the triumph of their struggle for national liberation, should however refuse to become a factor in that competition. The Third World ought not to be content to define itself in the terms of values which have preceded it. On the contrary, the underdeveloped countries ought to do their utmost to find their own particular values and methods and a style which shall be peculiar to them. The concrete problem we find ourselves up against is not that of a choice, cost what it may, between socialism and capitalism, as they have been defined by men of other continents and of other ages. Of course, we know that the capitalist regime, insofar as it is a way of life, cannot leave us free to perform our work at home, nor our duty in the world. Capitalist exploitation and cartels and monopolies are the enemies of underdeveloped countries. On the other hand, the choice of a socialist regime, a regime which is completely orientated toward the people as a whole and based on the principle that man is the most precious of all possessions, will allow us to go forward more quickly and more harmoniously, and thus make impossible that caricature of society where all economic and political power is held in the hands of a few who regard the nation as a whole with scorn and contempt. But in order that this regime may work to good effect, so that we can in every instance respect those principles which were our inspiration, we need something more than human output. Certain underdeveloped countries expend a huge amount of energy in this way. Men and women, young and old, undertake enthusiastically what is in fact forced labor and proclaim themselves the slaves of the nation. The gift of oneself and the contempt for every preoccupation which is not in the common interest bring into being a national morale which comforts the heart of man, gives him fresh confidence in the destiny of mankind, and disarms the most reserved observers. But we cannot believe that such an effort can be kept up at the same frenzied pace for very long. These young countries have agreed to take up the challenge after the unconditional withdrawal of the ex-colonial countries. The country finds itself in the hands of new managers. But the fact is that everything needs to be reformed and everything thought out anew. In reality, the colonial system was concerned with certain forms of wealth and certain resources only, precisely those which provisioned her own industries. Up to the present, no serious effort had been made to estimate the riches of the soil or of mineral resources. Thus, the young independent nation sees itself obliged to use the economic channels created by the colonial regime. It can, obviously, export to other countries and other currency areas, but the basis of its exports is not fundamentally modified. The colonial regime has carved out certain channels, and they must be maintained or catastrophe will threaten. Perhaps it is necessary to begin everything all over again, to change the nature of the country's exports, and not simply their destination, to re-examine the soil and mineral resources, the rivers, and why not, the sun's productivity. Now, in order to do all this, other things are needed over and above human output. Capital of all kinds, technicians, engineers, skilled mechanics, and so on. Let's be frank. We do not believe that the colossal effort which the underdeveloped peoples are called upon to make by their leaders will give the desired results. If conditions of work are not modified, centuries will be needed to humanize this world which has been forced down to animal level by imperial powers. The truth is that we ought not to accept these conditions. We should flatly refuse the situation to which the Western countries wish to condemn us. Colonialism and imperialism have not paid their score when they withdraw their flags and their police forces from our territories. For centuries, the capitalists have behaved in the underdeveloped world like nothing more than war criminals. Deportations, massacres, forced labor, and slavery have been the main methods used by capitalism to increase its wealth, its gold or diamond reserves, and to establish its power. Not long ago, Nazism transformed the whole of Europe into a veritable colony. The governments of the various European nations called for reparations and demanded the restitution in kind and money of the wealth which had been stolen from them. Cultural treasures, pictures, sculptures, and stained glass have been given back to their owners. There was only one slogan in the mouths of Europeans on the morrow of the 1945 V-Day. Quote, Germany must pay. Herr Adenauer, it must be said, at the opening of the Eichmann trial, and in the name of the German people, asked once more for forgiveness from the Jewish people. Herr Adenauer has renewed the promise of his people to go on paying to the State of Israel the enormous sums which are supposed to be compensation for the crimes of the Nazis. In the same way, we may say that the imperialist states would make a great mistake and commit an unspeakable injustice if they contented themselves with withdrawing from our soil the military cohorts and the administrative and managerial services whose function it was to discover the wealth of the country, to extract it, and to send it off to the mother countries. We are not blinded by the moral reparation of national independence, nor are we fed by it. The wealth of the imperial countries is our wealth too. On the universal plane, this affirmation, you may be sure, should on no account be taken to signify that we feel ourselves affected by the creations of Western arts or techniques. For in a very concrete way, Europe has stuffed herself inordinately with the gold and raw materials of the colonial countries, Latin America, China, and Africa. From all these continents, under whose eyes Europe today raises up her tower of opulence, there has flowed out for centuries toward that same Europe diamonds and oil, silk and cotton, wood and exotic products. Europe is literally the creation of the Third World. The wealth which smothers her is that which was stolen from the underdeveloped peoples. The ports of Holland, the docks of Bordeaux and Liverpool were specialized in the Negro slave trade and owe their renown to millions of deported slaves. So when we hear the head of a European state declare with his hand on his heart that he must come to the aid of the poor underdeveloped peoples, we do not tremble with gratitude. Quite the contrary, we say to ourselves, it's a just reparation which will be paid to us. Nor will we acquiesce in the help for underdeveloped countries being a program of, quote, Sisters of Charity. This help should be the ratification of a double realization, the realization by the colonized peoples that it is their due, and the realization by the capitalist powers that, in fact, they must pay. For if, through lack of intelligence, we won't speak of lack of gratitude, the capitalist countries refuse to pay, then the relentless dialectic of their own system will smother them. It is a fact that young nations do not attract much private capital. There are many reasons which explain and render legitimate this reserve on the part of the monopolies. As soon as the capitalists know, and of course they are the first to know, that their government is getting ready to decolonize, they hasten to withdraw all their capital from the colony in question. The spectacular flight of capital is one of the most constant phenomena of decolonization. Private companies, when asked to invest in independent countries, lay down conditions which are shown in practice to be unacceptable or unrealizable. Faithful to the principle of immediate returns, which is theirs as soon as they go overseas, the capitalists are very chary concerning all long-term investments. They are unamenable and often openly hostile to the prospective programs of planning laid down by the young teams which form the new government. At a pinch, they willingly agree to lend money to the young states, but only on condition that this money is used to buy manufactured products and machines. In other words, that it serves to keep the factories in the mother country going. In fact, the cautiousness of the Western financial groups may be explained by their fear of taking any risk. They also demand political stability and a calm social climate, which are impossible to obtain when account is taken of the appalling state of the population as a whole immediately after independence. Therefore, vainly looking for some guarantee which the former colony cannot give, they insist on garrisons being maintained or the inclusion of the young state in military or economic pacts. The private companies put pressure on their own governments to at least set up military bases in these countries for the purpose of assuring the protection of their interests. In the last resort, these companies ask their government to guarantee the investments, which they decide to make in such and such an underdeveloped region. It happens that few countries fulfill the conditions demanded by the trusts and monopolies. Thus, capital, failing to find a safe outlet, remains blocked in Europe and is frozen. It is all the more frozen because the capitalists refuse to invest in their own countries. The returns in this case are in fact negligible, and treasury control is the despair of even the boldest spirits. In the long run, the situation is catastrophic. Capital no longer circulates, or else its circulation is considerably diminished. In spite of the huge sums swallowed up by military budgets, international capitalism is in desperate straits. But another danger threatens it as well. Insofar as the Third World is in fact abandoned and condemned to regression, or at least to stagnation, by the selfishness and wickedness of Western nations, the underdeveloped peoples will decide to continue their evolution inside a collective autarky. Thus, the Western industries will quickly be deprived of their overseas markets. The machines will pile up their products in the warehouses, and a merciless struggle will ensue on the European market between the trust and the financial groups. The closing of factories, the paying off of workers, and unemployment will force the European working class to engage in an open struggle against the capitalist regime. Then the monopolies will realize that their true interests lie in giving aid to the underdeveloped countries, unstinted aid, with not too many conditions. So we see that the young nations of the Third World are wrong in trying to make up to the capitalist countries. We are strong in our own right and in the justice of our point of view. We ought, on the contrary, to emphasize and explain to the capitalist countries that the fundamental problem of our time is not the struggle between the socialist regime and them. The Cold War must be ended, for it leads nowhere. The plans for nuclearizing the world must stop, and large-scale investments and technical aid must be given to underdeveloped regions. The fate of the world depends on the answer that is given to this question. Moreover, the capitalist regime must not try to enlist the aid of the socialist regime over, quote, the fate of Europe in face of the starving multitudes of colored peoples. The exploit of Colonel Gagarin doesn't seem to displease General de Gaulle. For is it not a triumph which brings honor to Europe? For some time past, the statesmen of the capitalist countries have adopted an equivocal attitude toward the Soviet Union. After having united all their forces to abolish the socialist regime, they now realize that they'll have to reckon with it. So they look as pleasant as they can. They make all kinds of advances, and they remind the Soviet people the whole time that they, quote, belong to Europe. They will not manage to divide the progressive forces, which mean to lead mankind toward happiness, by brandishing the threat of a third world, which is rising like the tide to swallow up all Europe. The third world does not mean to organize a great crusade of hunger against the whole of Europe. What it expects from those who for centuries have kept it in slavery is that they will help it to rehabilitate mankind and make man victorious everywhere once and for all. But it is clear that we are not so naive as to think that this will come about with the cooperation and the goodwill of the European governments. This huge task, which consists of reintroducing mankind into the world, the whole of mankind, will be carried out with the indispensable help of the European peoples, who themselves must realize that in the past they have often joined the ranks of our common masters, where colonial questions were concerned. To achieve this, the European peoples must first decide to wake up and shake themselves, use their brains, and stop playing the stupid game of the...
I think they chopped off the last word. I'll read that final sentence just so everyone is together. To achieve this, the European peoples must first decide to wake up and shake themselves, use their brains, and stop playing the stupid game of the sleeping beauty. Who's the fairest of them all? Context of white supremacy. And so next week we will pick up spontaneity, its strength, and weakness. That's what we'll start at for next week. That subheading. Folks have commentary they would like to share. The number to dial 641-715-3640. The code 564-943-pound. Press star 6 if you would like to participate. All the folks who dialed in with a hand up, line should be open. Feel free if you would like to participate.
Yes, may I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Okay, I believe in this reading. It starts on an international context, and at the bottom of the first paragraph, it said, posing the problem of development of underdeveloped countries in this way seems to us to be neither right nor reasonable. So it is reasonable if you're going to exploit another country and take all of its natural resources from it, that you would at least upgrade the medical facilities, the infrastructure of that country. But what these white people do, and that answers a question that you asked earlier, why do white people love this book so much? And because he's not, Mr. Fanon is not really calling white people out. He's calling them everything but, you know, who they are. Who are the perpetrators of all of these injustices? And that would be white people, racist man, woman, and child. And then the underdeveloped countries that they have robbed and pilfered from do not get the benefit of any of the resources that they have taken from the country. And then the decolonization, after when they get the word that they're going to decolonize, then they start withdrawing all of their money from that country. And then that creates this serious problem. It's like a vacuum, because although you may have your independence, what are you going to do now? We take all the money out. You don't have any funding to do anything with. So your young nation is bound to fail. And he mentioned that a redistribution of wealth, you know, which probably would help rectify some things, but he goes on to say that that's very unlikely to happen. You know, mostly breaking it down, colonialism and imperialism have not settled their debts to us once they have withdrawn their flag and their police force from our territory. For centuries, the capitalists have behaved like real war criminals in the undeveloped world. And it's like what Mr. Fuller was saying, you know, racism, white supremacy is organized crime. They're the biggest criminals on the planet. And the fact that you call it colonization, they're just committing crimes all over the world. And then the one paragraph I didn't agree with, what he said, he was talking about the third world groveling at the feet of the capitalist countries. And he said, we are powerful in our own right and the justness of our position. It is our duty, however, to tell and explain to the capitalist country that they are wrong to think the fundamental issues of our time is the war between the socialist regime and them. I don't think that non-white people's position is to tell these white people anything. They already know. And if you feel like that, you're already heading in the wrong direction. So besides the last sentence that you wrote, that you mentioned about white people waking up and doing an irresponsible game of Sleeping Beauty, which is a metaphor, I'll mute my line of that. Thanks for taking the call.
Indeed. Other folks who dialed in with a hand up, thank you for the commentary, Mr. Demery Ford. If you got a hand up, line should be open. Proceed.
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Okay. I'm going to use the
Are you with us, sir? I heard you said
I accidentally hit the mute button again. My apologies.
Right on.
There was two sentences that caught my eye in regards to what's going on today. I'm going to use my translation. It says, the authorities of the oppression can appoint as many commissions of inquiry investigate as they like. In the eyes of the colonized, these commissions do not exist. And in fact, soon there will be 7 years of criminal acts committed in Algeria. Not a single Frenchman has been brought before a French court of justice for the murder of Algerian. This basically reminds me of white cops shooting unarmed black men. I don't see a prosecution of them. So it kind of like parallels that time and that what's going on today. So basically nothing has really changed. In the beginning of the program, I forgot his name.
Mumia Abu-Jamal.
Yeah, Abu-Jamal, when he was talking about, when he mentioned that Huey P. Newton had read the book 6 times. And I can actually understand why he would do that, because I think we talked about this last week in regards to being a very hard read because of the fact that it's, you know, using it's very wordy. As I'm reading it again, because I've read this before, but it's like now that I'm reading it and reading it with a group of people, it's sort of like changing my perspective on it, because one of the things, and I think somebody brought this up, you know, I guess the wording that he's using in regards to talking about the quote-unquote underdeveloped countries or underdeveloped world, he doesn't really explain why they're underdeveloped or how they're underdeveloped. You know, and Mr. Jimmy Ford talked about how he never talked about the, you know, how the white people basically rape these countries and why they don't have doctors and why they don't have an infrastructure. You know, it's almost like that these countries were just born underdeveloped, if you read his text. But he doesn't go into context of the history of what has happened. I mean, these countries have been invaded and, you know, been ripped apart. So that's why they're starving from hunger and famine and poverty, you know, because of them. So, yeah, I agree that he basically puts no blame on white people in all this and all the catastrophe that's going on in Africa. So, but like I said, it's very interesting, you know, reading him the second time and listening to and rereading the words and listening to the commentary of other people. So that's all I have on me in my line.
Appreciate that, sir. Other folks who dialed in with a hand up, proceed.
Can I be heard?
Oh, wait. Go ahead.
Oh, okay. Thank you. One thing I noticed, let's see. So far, I was a bit confused by this week's session, but one of the things I noticed was that Fanon uses the word violence a lot in this text. Down some notes. Aside from these, some terms that in Mr. Fuller's word guide are labeled with, quote, use with caution, specifically the words colonialism and violence, I was wondering what effect has this book had on its non-white readers and to what extent white people were aware of these effects. All I really know about this book is that many so-called militant non-white groups in the U.S. Had this book as required reading. I think I remember reading like an article where some members of the Black Panthers said that this book was given to them along with Malcolm X's autobiography. So I did a little bit of research on some reviews by white people of this specific book to see what aspects of it they emphasized. And I found an article on culturestories.co titled 10 Key Books to Explore Black Lives Matter. And I believe white people authored the article. Just some quotes from the article. It says, in the introduction, in 2012, Trayvon Martin was posthumously placed on trial for his own murder after his killer, George Zimmerman, was acquitted of his crime. In response, the Black Lives Matter movement was born, and the hashtag Black Lives Matter went viral. Black Americans and their allies took to the streets and the online sphere to advocate for dignity, justice, and respect in the face of dehumanizing violence against Black bodies and lives. An ideological and political intervention as much as an affirmation of humanity and resilience in the face of deadly oppression, Black Lives Matter movement continues to gain strength and momentum. In response and in an effort to continue the conversation, Culture Stories presents 10 key books to explore Black Lives Matter. From Fanon to Occult, there's something for everyone. The website is culturestories.co. And specifically, I think Wretched of the Earth was number 3 on the list. And the authors wrote about this book specifically, written in 1961 and translated from the French. The Wretch of the Earth is a book by Frantz Fanon, perhaps the most famous Martiniquan, a Marxist intellectual, political radical, psychiatrist, and philosopher. Fanon is the golden boy of post-colonial theory. In this foundational work, Fanon catalogs the dehumanizing effect colonization on the individual and nation, making the case for the application of violence that colonized on and against the colonizer, justifying it as psychological catharsis. Of colonialism, he writes, quote, it is violent in its natural state and it will only yield when confronted with greater violence, end quote. Then they go on to say, want a quick introduction? Check out Concerning Violence, a 2014 documentary film directed by Goran Olsen and narrated by singer Lauryn Hill. In their About Us section, they describe themselves as an online magazine and concept shop for women of style and substance, a website putting the cult back into culture, where art meets fashion and books meet travel essentials. You'll find our concept shop. Those are my thoughts so far. I guess since violence is a central theme, I was wondering how non-white people, how their behavior would be changed by this book. And I think my partner, she has some notes she took also on the book.
Hello?
Hi, partner.
Oh, hi. Sorry, this is Mel. I hope this counts as one person, not two, or two people, not one person. So I'm going to be pretty quick. So I came in on the second part, and there's a couple of issues there's a couple of things that are just confusing me about this part that I've heard so far concerning where Fanon is talking about international relations, I guess, after colonialism. And a few of the words that keep confusing me is the word reparation, the word nation, and there was one more word, but it's escaping my mind. I'm kind of winging it here. When Fanon says that, like, after Europeans leave, there's a certain amount of, like, output, basically, or productivity that a nation has. You know, they're producing so much sugarcane, so much tobacco. And then when the Europeans leave, they're all, like, starve, and people basically stop producing as much of the sugar and the tobacco as they were doing before. And Fanon seems to sort of, he points out how there is going to be a similar desire for that same output of productivity, either among the people or among the European nations that just exited. So part of me is thinking, if you've just kind of left colonial rule, there's really no need for you to have the same output of productivity, or how to put this? Like, I think there's a focus on once that nation leaves and stops ruling you, how does your nation then go forward? And when he talks about reparations, I'm trying to figure out, it's kind of like an army getting a bunch of guns and ammo, but then when they run out of the ammo, they don't know how to make bullets. So I'm trying to figure out what type of reparations does Fanon think that non-white people should have after colonialism? I think health care was brought up, or not health care, but like health systems, like either medicines or techniques of delivering health to people or actual equipment was brought up. And I'm just wondering, is that something that would be sustainable for these non-white countries after colonialism leaves? Do we still operate in the same currency? Even when he uses the word nation, for instance, when colonialists leave Ghana, does Ghana stay one nation of Ghana, or does it divide into the 3, 4, 18, or however many nations there were before that? That was the third word, leaders. I was trying to figure out how these leaders came about. Are these the same leaders who would lead the revolution, like a Nat Turner or a Toussaint, or is this a leader that's elected based on something else, like popular vote, or person who would be the best for an agrarian society where the farming is the goal? Those three words are kind of confusing me, just reparations, leader, and nation. I'm not sure what a nation it should look like after colonialism, and I'm not sure what reparations should look like afterward. And I'm kind of hoping maybe you'll go into more detail on that, but those are my thoughts so far. Oh, but I did like that he pointed out that the economies of Europe are generally based on the resource management, a.k.a. slavery and theft, of non-white nations. I thought that was a correct point to make, that when you look at when you look at Sweden or when you look at Britain, you're looking at a country that doesn't actually put out that much food itself. It doesn't actually do that much mining in its own country. It pretty much just manages the resources of other countries. So I thought that was pretty correct of him to point out. That was it.
grants two of our narrators from the book club. Mel, she read Asada Shakur's biography, and her partner, Delectable Negro, should maybe be in Gus's top 10. Grand to hear from both of them. The male caller who, actually, that was 1842. Emmy, did you have commentary, ma'am?
Can I be heard?
Yes, ma'am.
I had a couple of specific notes to the text, but then kind of like a couple of overall things. I would have appreciated the footnotes having been read, but I think that would have been awkward in a narrated text. But there is a lot of good information in some of the footnotes that are in the text. And there's one in specifically, I'll just read the beginning paragraph. Maybe it's footnote 7. I'm hoping the footnotes are still the same in other versions and stuff, but he's talking about the armed struggle. So in the armed struggle, there is what we would call the point of no return. It's almost always attributable to the sweeping repression, which encompasses every sector of the colonized population. This point was reached in Algeria in 1955 with 12,000 victims of Philippeville, and in 1956 by Lacoste's creation of rural and urban militias. And then that's where the footnote is. And it's a lengthy footnote, but there's a part in the 1, 2, 3, 4, fifth paragraph where it says, in 48 hours, 2,000 candidates were enrolled. The Europeans of Algeria immediately responded to Lacoste's call for murder. And so, I said, and they would do the exact same for Trump. And I appreciate that because, like Mr. Mumia Abu-Jamal had stated, that there are portions of the text that you could just transpose them onto today. And I think that's true. Like, you could just take out Lacoste's name and put Trump. And I think, you know, that is relevant. I would have appreciated, I think it might have been the previous male caller, actually. But I think that violence does need to be defined, like clearly defined what he's talking about. I think that creates a lot of confusion because he doesn't have like his own glossary or word guide or even a place where he says, when I say violence, this is what I mean. And so when you use such a word like violence that has such a strong connotation and different connotations for different people, then it conjures up different images and all of that in everybody's mind. But I think that would help to clarify what's being said. And I don't think that Black people have to be violent for white people to be violent against Black people. So being nonviolent doesn't mean that white people are going to cease being violent. And so I really appreciate a plethora of ideas for what to do in those type of situations, because I think that that is a very real reality, that white people are violent. So what do you do in a situation where this is not a negotiation? If you have a people who are violent, how do you respond to that violence? And I know throughout history we've seen various so-called leaders and various people do different things, but that's part of the reason I appreciate that violence is on the table as a conversation. And I also think that as a psychiatrist, him being a psychiatrist, that perhaps when he's talking violence, like as being a liberating thing, I interpret it literally, but I'm wondering also, is it possible that it's symbolic? There is a part where in the translation that I have, he says something about violence, and then he says something, I'll look here, I'm sorry, I even have like sticky notes, but they're kind of, but that it's like a symbolic thing too, that the non-white person is, here we go, for me it's 51, but it says, at the individual level, violence is a cleansing force. It rids the colonized of their inferiority complex, of their passive and despairing attitude. It emboldens them and restores their self-confidence. Even if the armed struggle has been symbolic, and even if they have been demobilized by rapid decolonization, the people have time to realize that liberation was the achievement of each and every one, and no special marriage to go to the leader. But I know that, you know, not everything is like, I don't know if he's saying that this liberating violence for the non-white person is, you know, the actual act of killing or doing something like that. But I think, you know, him being a psychiatrist, that there is that symbolic world where things are symbolic as well and not everything is literal. And who knows, like, how much he's pulling from, you know, if he, as Mr. Mumia Jamal had stated, as a psychiatrist, he was dealing with people who were soldiers and had been in all of these, like, violent situations. So that might be why there's such an emphasis on, like, as you're listening to people talk about their conflicting feelings about having killed somebody, like, man, I really feel messed up about it, but I also feel great at the same, like, you know, all of that stuff is, as a scientist and a psychiatrist, you're noting it. And I think that he's trying to present it in a way that's like, you know, he might not be talking about the other side, that there is a dehumanizing aspect of violence, but for the non-white person to be performing violence in whatever way that that is, being liberating, I think is worthy of talking about. But Gus, is that you wrapping me up? Have I talked too long?
Gus was okay, muted.
Okay, I thought I heard you like unmute, so I was ready to go ahead and wrap this up, but I'll be quick. And I think that violence, it has many forms. Like, violence doesn't mean that you actually physically are violent against people. You can be violent in your words and things like that as well. So non-white people, the truth is the violence is there. For me, when I say the truth, I mean, for me, in my opinion, that violence is there. And when it's not talked about, when it's not given a space to go as an energy, if it's not not dissipated in the sense that it is diminished but moved forward in a productive way, it comes out in non-constructive, non-productive ways, and having violence within families or violence between each other and things like that, when really that violence is meant for them. You know, so I'm just saying that it's important to address that. And just because that, like, well, it doesn't matter. I think I've said all that I wanted to say about it, so thank you.
Right on. Do we have any other folks who dialed in with a hand up who wanted to comment? Anybody with a hand up that we missed?
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Greetings, everyone. Be patient with me because, I came in late on a very difficult read. But I do know the subject is violence, and I've heard some of the ideas from Mr. Fanon and from some of the other callers. First and foremost, the reason why I think white people like the book, because it is talking about violence. And it's a somewhat of a narrow form of violence. When they are having sex with us, they are violating us. So that's violence. The main weapon of white people that practice racism and white supremacy is not violence, not direct violence anyway, it's deception. And because overwhelmingly the byproduct of deception to the non-white body is confusion. And through confusion, we end up violating each other for the most part, more so than even thinking about defending ourselves from white supremacy. In that confusion, and so I can see why the book would be endorsed by a lot of white people, and hopefully I made some sense in that in the comments. I think the most proficient developing that non-white people need to be doing is focusing directly on our individual, therefore collective behavior would become, because what it would do to the system of racist white supremacy, it would create a environment. It can create an environment that is so clean that their dirtiness would not be able to affect, won't be as effective and actually, I think it would end up annihilating their incorrect efforts, is what I'm saying. Just our behavior. And what is so impactful about Mr. Fuller's idea is you don't have to have no meetings, you don't have to have no club or anything like that, collecting any dues, finding a way to the meeting place. The meeting place is the reflection of the person you see in the mirror. And they can kill us individually, but I don't think I think that the process that at the process of non-white people modifying and correcting their behavior individually based on developing and rallying around codified behavior that's based on logic is the ultimate weapon. That's basically what I'm saying. It's the ultimate weapon that they cannot defeat, because what they're doing is direct opposite of that. And I better shut up before I get any more off course. So thank you for listening.
For sure, retired firefighter. Thanks for the commentary. We pretty much are done. Did we miss anybody? Anybody have a hand up that we missed? Getting to the close, just making sure. We miss anybody? I'll be pretty quick. I've been thinking it quite a bit, that this book, in my opinion, has not aged well. It reads, it sounds, it feels very dated, reading this book that was published in 1961 and 2017. Not in a matter like, oh, this is, yeah, I'll fix it there. But the other point is that it feels dated in another manner that, oh, okay, a black psychiatrist wrote a book about racism. That's, you know, I know a black psychiatrist who wrote a book about racism. I mean, you can even have that in mind. Why is it that this book white people adore? I even thought it was significant because of the other black psychiatrist that I know of who wrote a book about racism. That book, I suspect, would have something to say about Frantz Fanon being referred to as the golden boy of colonial studies. After all that, still not a man, just a boy. But that is something to keep in mind as well. Why is it this book so beloved, as though this is the only time a black psychiatrist had something to say in book format about racism? The other quick thought, the cat, I think Mr. Fuller, when I heard him say that he still didn't know what a socialist was, what a capitalist was, what a communist was, he still didn't have an idea. I think all of those terms are in the original code book and the updated version. And I think even the word got too. But he said, hey, at the end of the day, the master capitalists are racists, white supremacists, and the master communists, socialists, are also racists, white supremacists. I thought that was very important because there seemed to be some confusion around that in this week's portion of the reading as well. I will end it there. I will give a robust thanks to all the folks who have supported the cows this week, specifically my wish list. I was not even able to broadcast yesterday because of extraordinary back pain, which I said during the brief stint that we were on yesterday. I posted it on Facebook as well. But the timing, we don't do the broadcast yesterday immediately after I go off air. I go to lie down in pain and I sleep for about 2 hours. I wake up and my massager is on the front door from my wish list. I had it there way before I had any back issues, but oh man, it has been very, very timely. And I think that had a lot to do with me being able to endure being on to broadcast today, because I'm still in some discomfort, but
I've had a few massages as we have been broadcasting. It has been grand. So hopefully we'll be here tomorrow and I'll be feeling even better. Much obliged to all the folks for participating. We'll be here next week, session number 4. France been on the Wretched of the Earth. You can feel free to email your commentary as well, untiljustice@gmail.com. We'll be here tomorrow for the compensatory call-in, 9 p.m. Eastern, 8 p.m. Central, 6 p.m. Pacific. If you have questions, gripes, can't find something in the archives, guest suggestion, drop us an email, untiljustice@gmail.com. With that, I will encourage everyone to remain sober. Sobriety would be best under the system of racism, white supremacy. Racists have terrorized us for a long time, and I don't think we put ourselves in a better position to neutralize their terrorist attack when we're intoxicated and not able to make phenomenal decisions. I mean, you might have to make a life-saving decision. I think Trayvon Martin was referenced earlier. This is the 3-year anniversary this week, 3-year anniversary of Michael Brown Jr., allegations of cannabis perhaps being involved. And then John Crawford III, also the anniversary where he was shot and killed in Ohio 3 years ago, back in 2014, in a Walmart with a toy gun. No prosecution there either. I think France Fanon talked about that. But I don't think any of those situations would have been better if they had guzzled a six-pack before Michael Brown Jr. went out to have his stroll, or before John Crawford III went to Walmart. I don't think that would have made the situation better, and I think that's the way that we should be thinking. We might have to make a life-saving decision at any moment under the system of white terrorism. Sobriety would be best. That's it, Creator. We ask that you help us remain patient with other Black people. Victims of white supremacy, we ask that you help us remain patient with ourselves. Remind us to demonstrate the highest levels of Black self-respect at all times, in all places, each and every time we are in contact with another Black person. It has been time. Replace white supremacy with justice immediately. Kyle signing out. Thanks all for tuning in.
Nigga, you so brainwashed.
I'm a victim,
your
brother.
Problem. You're a victim.
Shut I'm up. A victim of 400 years of conditioning.
Shut up.
The man has programmed my condition.
Mm-hmm.
Even my conditioning has been conditioned.